I thought Irishmen had potatoes.
My God, don't do this. Please, don't do this.
It looks like...
Think of your family. Think of your family. Think of everybody.
You're just smuggling some tater tots.
For God's sakes, no. Oh, God. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, God, Almighty, no.
Okay, are you proud of yourself now? Look at him. Look at that stinking smile on his face.
Oh, in God's name.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
45 days. We are 45 days away until Lucha Underground Season 2. I think we're going to count down the days each week on this podcast until we get there. So mark it down. Wednesday, January 27th, 8 p.m. Eastern on the El Rey Network. It's back. And if you missed any of the first season, El Rey is going to be running a 40-hour marathon of the entire first season starting on Saturday, January 23rd at 10 o'clock in the morning, all the way through to Sunday the 24th at 2 o'clock in the morning. So if you've never seen Lucha Underground, if you've only seen a few episodes here and there, here's your chance. You can get all caught up right before the new season starts. I cannot wait. Especially with some of the wrestling I've seen lately, I cannot wait for Season 2 of Lucha Underground with Rey Mysterio. That was the big news that broke last night. Lucha Underground on Twitter posted a tweet that said, El Rey comes to El Rey. So it is official. It's been rumored for a long time now. They've been working on a deal, but I guess they have signed the contract. And Rey Mysterio will be part of Season 2 of Lucha Underground. And they've also released the new trailer for Season 2 of Lucha Underground. It's up on the El Rey Network YouTube channel. If you haven't already seen it, stop what you're doing and go watch it. Because it is pure awesomeness. This is a freaking sick trailer hyping up the upcoming season. Just tremendously well done. And you can see why they, you know, want to put so much effort into the production of the show. And it just is so different than any other wrestling television show. But they do it right. You know, with all the characters and all the different stories that intertwine. It's just, it's tremendous stuff. So if you haven't seen the trailer, definitely head on over to the YouTube channel over there and check it out. So only 45 more days to go. This is episode 413 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here on TLC Sunday, December the 13th, 2015. I am the Solid Monster. I want to thank everybody who has been voting to nominate the Sound Off in the Wrestling Radio Awards. We are looking to repeat here in 2016 as the show of the year, so if you haven't already done so, you can vote once a day, every day. Go to WrestlingRadioAwards.com. Scroll down. They have a whole bunch of different categories. And what you want to do is go down. I think it's the second row maybe on the left. It's the Show of the Year category. Just type in the full name of the podcast, Solid Monster Sounds Off, and click Submit. Of course, you could vote for other shows and other categories if you want to. But then make sure you scroll down and click Submit. You could do that every single day, just once. I have no idea when the nominating period ends, but it's still ongoing, so please do cast your vote for the Sound Off. Also, thank you for people who continue to sign up for Audible. We're heading into the end of the year here, and we want to end strong. We need your help for that. So use our URL, audibletrial.com/solidmonster. You can sign up for a 30-day trial of the Audible service. You get one free audio book of your choosing. It could be anything they have available, and they've got thousands of books online. It's a free book from us. Our holiday gift from us to you. So if you've already used it, maybe you can spread the link around to other people. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. And thank you to everybody who made a PayPal donation. You can make one on the Solomonster.com. PayPal box is on the right-hand side. Any day of the week, night or day, you want to make a donation, it's always there. And I very much appreciate it. I want to say thank you to Hot Stuff, Hector Pena, Sean Nasty Boy Nilsson, Deadpool James Herrera, Bobby the Wizard Waldrop, Trevon the Cannon Clark, John Loose Cannon Lopez, the Marietta Mauler, Alexandru Mata, and Damn Straight Michael Dorsey. Thank you very much for your support of the podcast. If you want to make a donation and get a wrestling nickname, just a fun little thing we do here, $10 or more, we'll get you a nickname. And again, thank you very much for all your support. Now, I want to mention before we move on here, I kind of teased something on Twitter a few days ago. I want to talk a little bit more about what I meant when I posted about it. I am working on a little bit of an ambitious WCW-related project here, very similar to what we finished up a few weeks ago when I did my top 8 countdown. It was a top 8 countdown of my favorite WWE matches, or I should say 8 of my favorite, not necessarily the top 8. And it was very well received. I didn't really hear a negative word about it, except from people who said, oh, you should have included this match or that match, but everybody seemed to enjoy it. I enjoyed it. It allowed me to go back and rewatch some matches I haven't seen in a very long time, and it was a lot of fun. And it was pointed out to me a while ago, several weeks ago, that we are coming up on the 15-year anniversary of the death of WCW. Now, I personally consider the death of WCW to be the final Nitro. Final Nitro aired, I believe, March 26. It's the end of March, 2001. To me, that was the end of WCW. That was the death. And it's coming up on the 15-year anniversary, and so I calculated it, and I said, well, what if we did another type of countdown? What if we did a countdown of the 15 best matches in WCW history? And I am a little less familiar with some of like the older WCW stuff. And what I mean by that is, I mean, I've seen a lot of it by now, but I didn't really grow up a WCW fan, so a lot of those old WWE matches, I didn't even have to go back and watch some of them. I remembered most of them. I grew up on them. WCW, not so much. I've been watching a lot of WCW the last several weeks, just to brush up on different matches that stood out to me. I just put together originally when I came up with the idea, I said, let me put down a list of what I think are my favorite or the best WCW matches. And I had a list of like 24 or 26 or something. So I've narrowed that list down to 15. And the way we're going to work this is, it's not a ranked list. So we're not doing, you know, number 15 is the least best and number 1 is the best. But these are, in my opinion, the 15 best matches in WCW history. And we're going to do one match a week on the Sound Off, basically 15 weeks of Match Anatomy from here, starting next week. So that's the December 20th show, going all the way to the end of March, culminating on the anniversary of the death of WCW. And so that's what we're going to be doing. And it's going to be fun. It's something different than WWE. We don't talk about a whole lot of WCW, and I just thought 15-year anniversary, now's as good a time as any to go back and take a look at. I mean, believe me, there's plenty more than 15 matches we could point to as far as some of the shittiest matches in WCW history. I think a lot of them happened in the last few years of that promotion. But there were a lot of damn good matches in that company. Some that don't get as much attention maybe as they should. Some of them do. A lot of the ones that you may think are going to be part of the list, I'm sure, are on there. There may be a few that aren't. Maybe a few surprises. But I put the list together. I've narrowed it down. It's been hard because I wanted to get that number down to 15. But I've managed to get the number down to 15. It will be in no particular order. And we're going to start next week and then go for another 14 weeks after that. So it should be a lot of fun. And actually, later in the show, we have a Match Anatomy here this week. It was requested by one of our listeners, Barry in Hawaii. It's like our current president, another Barry from Hawaii. Anyway, it's a TNA match, a rare TNA Match Anatomy from 2006. It's actually Sting and Abyss for the NWA World Heavyweight title. So that'll be your Match Anatomy later on in the podcast here this week. Speaking of Sting, I hate to say it, but it sure sounds like he may have wrestled his last match. He was on Ric Flair's podcast this week, talked about the injury against Seth Rollins at Night of Champions, the two buckle bombs, which I am still just flabbergasted that he would take two. I mean, even one is crazy, but two, you're just asking for something bad to happen. A guy half his age takes that move, and it looks brutal, let alone a 56-year-old man. He says WWE's doctor told him he needs neck surgery for cervical spinal stenosis. He has two areas in his neck that are kind of being choked off, is how he put it. He says he's lucky a catastrophe didn't happen that night against Rollins, which doesn't sound good. So he says he's got to get it fixed, and really, any sort of major surgery at his age, let alone neck surgery, between that and the other little matter here of WWE clearing him, even if he wanted to wrestle again, you know, he said in the interview he thinks he's got one last great match left in him, and I'm sure he really doesn't want his career to end like that, but I think he's done. I think he's done. And if this is the end, you know what? He went out wrestling for the world championship in WWE, in the biggest company in the world, which he hadn't wrestled in ever in his entire career. He was in the main event of a pay-per-view, wrestling the best in the company for the world title. Not a bad way to go out. Not a bad way to go out. Other than the fact that he lost the last two big matches of his career, which is kind of sad that it worked out that way. You know, I just don't see how they tell Edge, who wasn't even 40 when he retired, I don't see how they tell Edge, you can't ever wrestle again because of spinal stenosis, but then they turn around and they let a guy who's almost 60, or may almost be 60 by the time he's able to come back, I mean, if he ends up having spinal fusion surgery, we don't know the nature of the neck surgery yet, neither does he. So, a guy who's going to be almost 60 years old, you know, letting him back in one of their rings after they said no to Edge for what appears to be the same or similar type of injury, I just don't see it. I just don't see it. You know, Jerry Lawler had his heart attack, wasn't even inside the ring. Turned out to be a blockage, I think. It wasn't even really a heart attack. It was like a blockage in an artery. And they haven't even let him wrestle another match since. And that was, what, 2012 when that happened? It's been 2-3 years? Daniel Bryan finds two doctors to clear him and tell him he's okay, and they still won't let him back in the ring? You think they're going to let Sting? Maybe, but I'd be shocked if it happened. I think Sting is going into the Hall of Fame, probably in Dallas next year, and that may be his swan song. And really, when you look at what he did in WWE, I don't even know that it's worth it for him to get back in the ring. Other than, again, in his mind, I just can't let my career end that way, and maybe they would give him a big win. I ain't going to hold my breath on that. I don't have any interest in seeing this guy come back just to lose. So, honestly, I think he should just call it a day and not tempt fate anymore, because it's not worth it. He's had a great career. You could argue whether or not they used him the right way here in WWE. You know, he had a couple of big matches. And it's sad that it happened, but it happened, and sometimes you just got to leave well enough alone, and I think that may be the case here with Sting. So let's move on from that and talk about TLC. TLC is tonight on pay-per-view, or on the WWE Network, whatever. I guess if you order it on pay-per-view, according to them, you are an idiot. It is tonight from Boston, Massachusetts. And as I record this show, this could change as the day goes on, but as I am recording this, no match for Team Bad or Sasha Banks. And I mention that because Sasha Banks is a Boston girl. I know she's a heel, but nonetheless, it is her hometown. It would be, I'm sure, a big night for her to appear in her hometown inside a WWE ring, as opposed to an NXT ring. And she has no match, unless they add something maybe to the pre-show at the last minute. Right now, there is no announced pre-show match. Boston or not, the fact that they are having a pay-per-view and Sasha Banks does not have some kind of feature match, I mean, wherever it's being held, that's a crime in and of itself. The fact that it's in Boston just makes it worse. But here's the rest of the card, as of right now. We'll start from the bottom, work our way up top. Ryback and Rusev was added this past week to the pay-per-view. No stipulation announced for it, just a straight-up singles match. They've already had a couple of matches, maybe more than a couple, on TV. The last we saw of Rusev and Ryback on Raw, I didn't see their stuff on SmackDown. But on Raw, we saw Lana kind of turning on Ryback in a way. And I say turning on Ryback in that she was, up to that point, feigning the fact that she had concern or respect for Ryback because of, I don't know, some nonsense. I try not to pay attention to this stupid shit. But in the end, she smiled when Ryback was being put in the accolade outside the ring, and they said, oh, well, Lana really didn't give a shit about Rusev all along, and whatever. The last image I saw of either one of these guys was Ryback being put in the submission hold. So I figure it's time for Ryback to get himself a win. And I'm going to go with Ryback. Not that it matters, but Ryback is my pick in this match. The Divas Championship is on the line. We have Charlotte with her dad, Ric Flair, in her corner, defending the title against Paige. I don't see them taking the title off Charlotte so soon, and I was going to say I think it would be a mistake. But again, doesn't matter. It's kind of sad that I keep saying that, and maybe there's people listening who would disagree with me, but honestly, I look up and down this card, not a goddamn thing matters. It doesn't even matter. It doesn't even matter. Nothing feels like it matters. So they want to change the title? Change the title. Who gives a shit? I don't think the title is changing. In fact, other than Ryback, I may as well just say it here, I'm predicting every other heel on the show is going to win, or at least retain their title if they're in a championship match. Ryback was the only babyface here that I have who I'm picking. I have Charlotte going over Paige. We have the United States Championship on the line in a chairs match. Alberto Del Rio and Jack Swagger. A WrestleMania 29 World Championship rematch, if you can believe that. There's no way Del Rio is losing this title to Swagger. I mean, there's just no way. Now, on Raw last Monday, they had a split, or what appeared to be a split, between Zeb and Del Rio. And the question is it legit? Is it all just a swerve? I don't think it's a swerve. I think they realized this was a mistake, and they split them up, and that's that. I'm sure Zeb will be there. Maybe he'll even be involved in some way. I don't think it's a swerve, though. Del Rio, by the way, is wrestling Brock Lesnar at a house show in Los Angeles next weekend. Brock Lesnar is contracted for a certain number of house show dates. Next Saturday is one of them. As of right now, it's not supposed to be on the network unless they announce it this weekend, which they would have to because they don't have a lot of time left. But right now, it's not supposed to be on TV. And that sucks. You know, I would much rather see that match than this one, I'll tell you that. You know, when Del Rio came back, I said here on the podcast, the two opponents that I would like to see Lesnar in the ring with, who I just think their styles, it would go well, it would be a fresh match, were Del Rio and Cesaro. And they're doing one of those matches now, but they're doing it at a house show. But they're giving us Jack Swagger on a pay-per-view. Think about that. The people in L.A. are getting Del Rio and Lesnar, likely not on television, but we get Swagger and Del Rio on pay-per-view. Seems kind of ass backwards to me. We have the Wyatt family against the Dudley Boys, Tommy Dreamer and Rhino. I was going to call him the Man Beast, but on TV Monday night they called him the Gore Machine. I've never fucking heard Rhino referred to as the Gore Machine, but according to Michael Cole, they call him the Gore Machine. So I guess that's what we're calling him now. 8-man elimination tables match. Wyatt family, I mean, they have to, right? I mean, come on. If they can't beat the ECW crew, then I think the Wyatt family ought to just retire, and that should be the end of the Wyatt family in WWE. It's win or die, as far as I'm concerned, for these guys. They have to win. I mean, they just have to. So I'm picking the Wyatt family here. We have the New Day, the Usos, and the Lucha Dragons ladder match, three-way for the Tag Team Championship. I would not take those titles off the New Day. Until they promote some teams from NXT like Jordan and Gable or Kaz and Enzo, I wouldn't even bother taking the titles off New Day. Let New Day hold them until they promote one of those two teams. I don't care if it's 6 months from now. Just keep the titles on New Day. I mean, they're one of the few redeeming things about the TV shows now, even if they are getting overexposed. But I would not take the titles off New Day. So they're my pick. Kevin Owens and Dean Ambrose for the Intercontinental Championship. May have the best match on the show. Could be the sleeper match. We'll see. I would not take the title off Kevin Owens. And I say that as somebody who hates it when they have Dean Ambrose lose, which they do a lot. But in this case, I'd rather see Kevin Owens retain, even if it's some, you know, non-finish or, you know, bullshit. I don't want him to walk out of the match or anything, but maybe they extend the feud a little bit longer, but I would not take the title off him. I still maintain the way to go. I know Sami Zayn is coming back to NXT, but I still maintain the way to go at the Royal Rumble. You have Zayn, even as a surprise, in the Rumble. He eliminates Owens. It's a natural feud, and you let them feud over the championship. Maybe give Sami the big title win at WrestleMania. Owens has held the title for a long time. I just don't see a reason to take that title off him right now. And I hope they don't. And I don't think they will. He's my pick. Main event is Sheamus and Roman Reigns for the WWE Championship in a tables, ladders, and chairs match. And I have a lot to say about that main event segment on Raw last Monday, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. I think these two guys will go out there and they will have a very good match because they're not, you know, they're not bad wrestlers. They're in a big position. They know they're in a big position. They've got all the toys to play with. It's very hard to have a bad TLC match, right? Think about it. Think of all the TLC matches you've ever seen. Can you think of a really bad one, like, immediately that comes to mind? Because, I mean, maybe there has been an atrocious TLC match, but I can't think of one. At the very least, they're good. Most of the time, they're very good or they're great. They're classic in some cases. Hard to have a bad TLC match. So I think this will be good. I don't think they're putting the title on Roman Reigns. I think if they were going to go that route, they would have done it at Survivor Series. I guess they did do it at Survivor Series, but they would have kept the title on him. Whatever decision they've made, clearly they are delaying the coronation. I don't think they delayed the coronation to do it on TLC, a show that nobody cares about. So Sheamus is going to retain. How? I don't know. I'm not even going to venture a guess. Could be a screwjob finish. I'm sure he's not just going to beat him clean. I don't care enough to even venture a guess other than Sheamus is my pick. I predict Sheamus to retain. A strong night for heels. I think that's what we're going to get tonight at the pay-per-view. So that's your TLC rundown. Monday Night Raw, episode 1176, was live from Charleston, South Carolina last Monday night. And by the way, before I go any further, I want to say thank you. All the feedback I got to my column on TJRWrestling.net about Vince McMahon's obsession with having just one guy that he builds everything around and why it's not doing not only the company any favors, he ain't doing Roman Reigns any favors by putting him in that position. And I'm telling you, I didn't say it before when I was talking about TLC, but they had better hope that Roman Reigns makes it out of that TLC match unscathed and not hurt. Because if he doesn't, oh boy, it's going to be bad times for WWE if he gets hurt, seriously hurt, in that match. But they put all their eggs in one basket, so if something happens, they got nobody to blame but themselves. The Raw Instapoll continues to be something else. 1,384 of you voted. 85% thumbs down. Only 15% thumbs up. And let me tell you something. Fans fleeing Raw, running away, giving up, is a real phenomenon. It is not an internet thing. My brother, who, like me, has watched this stuff for much of his life, has completely given up on the product, which actually makes me very sad when, because, you know, when we weren't actually watching it together, we would text about things that happened or joke about it or whatever, and I realize it's been 5 or 6 weeks, and he just hasn't watched and hasn't looked back. He just doesn't care. he gave up. And after watching the show last Monday, you know what? I can't say that I blame him. There was chatter about a day or two before the show that things were going to be different in some way. WWE heard the fan feedback. They might be changing things up a little bit this past week. The only thing they changed was taking the main event at the end of the show, typically, and putting it at the beginning of the show, and moving the very long, boring promo to the end of the show. That's it. That was the big change. And there was a great illustration that somebody did, I wish I knew who did it, of Vince McMahon and his writers. It was this great like comic strip type graphic of Vince McMahon and his writers talking about, you know, how we need new ideas for Raw. And you see six-man tag written on a piece of paper, which is their, you know, tried and true every week with the six-man tags. And then in the panel right beneath it, somebody just took a pen and wrote the number 1 before the 6 to make it 16-man tag. I laughed my fucking ass off when I saw that picture because it's so true. That's exactly what they did. Now, I will tell you, I missed the first 15 minutes of this show. I was watching something else, didn't even feel any particular urge to change the channel, nor did I have the urge to, and I have it on DVR, I didn't even feel the urge to go back and watch what I missed. Usually I'll just like start from the beginning if I missed the first 10 or 20 minutes. I didn't even care. So I put it on, I saw virtually the entire roster just thrown into the opening match. I have no idea what was even going on. As far as the beginning of the show, from what I read, the League of Losers came out with some new music that they now have. They were confronted by the Wyatt family, which apparently the crowd actually seemed to be into. Rhino came back as a member of Team TNA, or ECW. I mean, there's really no difference between the two, let's be honest. And then Roman and his family came out, and that led to this 16-man, 4-team elimination match. Fun match. Fun match. Best part of the whole show. I enjoyed it. Crowd was lively for it. They were into it. Tommy Dreamer pinned Eric Rowan to eliminate the entire Wyatt family. So that was something else to see. Roman Reigns pinned Sheamus with a spear to win the match for his team. It was at this point that I realized we still had another 2.5 hours left in the show. And they were probably going to be double dipping. Because how could they not? I mean, we have 16 guys in that one match alone. They don't have enough guys to fill the next 2.5 hours. And so that's exactly what they did. They double dipped. They double dipped the chip is what they did on this show. Kevin Owens and Dolph Ziggler had a long match. Owens won with the pop-up powerbomb out of nowhere. Tyler Breeze was out there watching, never got involved. But fear not, because Dolph Ziggler beat him on SmackDown. Again, this time in less than 5 minutes. So thanks for coming, Tyler Breeze. Dean Ambrose came out after this match with popcorn and a soda, and he threw it in Kevin Owens' face. Naomi and Sasha Banks, who again do not, as I record this, have a match at TLC, beat Team Bella, which was comprised of Brie Bella and Alicia Fox, who does a pretty mean tilt-a-whirl slam, I will say. Team Bad now does this thing where they say the word unity, right? That's how, I hope I'm doing that right. They say it in that very goofy, high-pitched voice, right? They just go, unity, unity, like this gimmick is shitty. Oh my God, as if that isn't bad enough. The New Day comes out. And they give each of the members of Team Bad a flashing dildo to wear on their head. And then Sasha dances. What the fuck have they done to this woman? What have they done? The light up dildo, and people probably listening to this, because I know a lot of you don't watch this show anymore. And by the way, you have the right idea. So you're probably thinking to yourself, wait a minute, they gave them dildos? No. The light up dildo is really a unicorn horn headband that lights up, which sold out on WWE Shop 5 hours after they put them on sale. So, good for the New Day. New Day talked about their match at TLC. Xavier Woods said ladders are for things like getting kittens out of trees, and they don't need to use ladders at the pay-per-view. And so they reenacted a cat getting caught in a tree. Kofi Kingston hopped on Big E's back. He meowed. Xavier tried to talk him down. This really happened, by the way. And I did laugh at it, as ridiculous as it was. I did laugh at that. But my God, you know, when I pitched my Roman Empire idea before Survivor Series, and I floated as part of that, if you remember, the idea of Team Bad maybe being associated in some way, maybe not right away, but being associated with the group, you know, because you have Naomi as Jimmy Uso's wife, even though now apparently they're not. They don't acknowledge it on television. You would never know. But she is. And Tamina, of course, is part of the whole, the Samoan connection there. The idea, though, was that it might also help make Sasha Banks a bigger deal by associating her with the top heel faction, had they gone through with this. Instead, Roman is talking about tater tots, and Sasha's dancing with a fucking strap on her head. What the fuck? I mean, seriously, what the fuck? I don't even know what else to say about this. It was a Miz TV segment with Ric Flair and Charlotte. Charlotte scolded Miz for not introducing her father correctly. Flair said he would be in his daughter's corner at the pay-per-view. Miz started talking to Charlotte, asking her questions that she just wouldn't answer. Ric got in his face. I love how, by the way, they never acknowledged the fact that Flair once gave Miz the figure four leg lock. He bestowed his move on the Miz because he thought so highly of him. And he did it for all of maybe 6 weeks before they just dropped the entire thing. Now they pretend like it never happened. Miz then surprised both of them by bringing out Paige, who earlier in the segment he had teased wasn't even there. She comes out, Paige gets a babyface pop. When she got into the ring, Charlotte bailed. I have no idea what's going on anymore. A few weeks ago, Paige is out there insulting her dead brother, and Charlotte just wants to tear this woman apart They're having this big brawl around the ring, which Ric Flair said was like Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker because, you know, maybe he fucking missed his medication that day or something. I don't know why you would say that. And now Charlotte is backing down from Paige, and we're supposed to cheer for her. So Paige slapped Ric Flair in the face. Flair told his daughter to get her. So Charlotte gets in the ring and goes after Paige. And then Paige, like a coward, rolled out of the ring to get away from her. I will say one good thing about this. Charlotte does seem much more comfortable on the microphone playing the bitch role, the heel bitch. But otherwise, this sucked. And I realize I don't like either one of these women, and therefore I don't care who wins or who loses in their match tonight. I don't care. So, well done. By the way, on his podcast last week, Flair said that he heard, the current plan for WrestleMania is for Charlotte to wrestle either Sasha or Bayley. Why he would say that publicly, I have no idea. Probably not the best thing for his daughter to be blabbing like that. And I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I already pitched my idea would be Sasha winning the championship from Charlotte at WrestleMania and then dumping the butterfly belt in the trash the next night and bringing back the women's title. Now, Bayley is an interesting name for him to drop there because I think it's too soon. I mean, Bayley going to WrestleMania to fight for the championship, he's not even on the main roster yet. I mean, I still like the idea better for Bayley if you're going to try to come up with an idea to bring her up in the next few months. And again, something, I keep saying this, but I just want people to understand who may not have listened to this podcast before, these ideas that I'm talking about here have been pitched on this show before. Like a few weeks ago, we were talking about this, about the idea maybe of getting Stephanie McMahon involved. Bayley wants to come up to the main roster and Stephanie won't let her. She thinks she's a little girl. She's not tough enough to be on the main roster, whatever. But you get Stephanie involved so that Bayley can win herself a spot on the roster and get one over on Stephanie, which almost nobody ever does. I can't say nobody. Every now and then somebody does. Very, very rare that Triple H or Stephanie get shown up by somebody, especially Stephanie. So if Bayley becomes one of the few people to do it, all of a sudden, hey, you know, she's got some credibility. If there's a way to get somebody new over, you have them one-up Stephanie McMahon. Having Bayley wrestle for the championship in April when she's not even on the main roster yet, it just seems a little too quick. They need to take their time to get that character over with the masses, or else she's going to end up like Emma. I don't want to see her. I mean, I love Emma, but we saw what happened when she got called up. I don't want to see what happened to Emma happen to Bayley. I think Charlotte and Sasha sounds good to me, but again, Flair should probably keep his mouth shut when it comes to stuff like that. They joined a Jack Swagger versus Stardust match already in progress. It started during the commercial break. Stardust hurt his leg during the match. He had an MRI done. He's waiting on the results. Hopefully he gets some good news back. I think the last thing they need right now is another guy on the injured list. Swagger won with the Patriot Lock. Del Rio showed up and attacked him with a chair. Swagger got a chair of his own. He knocked Del Rio's out of his hands like a little sword fight. And when Del Rio went to retreat, he tripped backwards over Zeb's motorized scooter and then ran away. That, however, led to backstage. Del Rio chewed him out, said, "I don't need you anymore, old man." And so it would appear that their act is no more. Now, again, maybe it's a swerve. We'll find out tonight. I don't think it is, but either way, this was a bad idea from day one. Not surprising that, from what I read, from what I understand, the ideas was Vince McMahon's idea. Why am I not surprised? They did another Rosebush segment with Adam Rose. He made fun of Neville with a graphic by putting Dumbo ears on his head. This segment fucking sucked. This entire third hour was quite possibly the worst hour of television they produced all year. And that's saying something. First hour was not bad at all. Second hour, really, not that great. Third hour was just atrocious. This third hour represented everything that is wrong with this television show. So from this garbage with Adam Rose, we went to a Tommy Dreamer versus Braun Strowman match. So for the one guy on Twitter, I don't know if he was trying to be a wise ass or not, but for the one guy on Twitter who after I tweeted during the show, I didn't even comment on it. All I said was, Tommy Dreamer just eliminated the entire Wyatt family, okay, in that opening match. And the person said, well, it's good booking because the babyface has got to win over the heels before the pay-per-view. Yeah, well, on the same show, they turned right back around and had Braun Strowman destroy Tommy Dreamer and beat him in 2 minutes. Okay, so even Steven strikes again. You tell me what good that does anybody. Not that I care anyway. It's fucking Braun Strowman and Tommy Dreamer. Who could possibly give a shit? We then had one of the absolute worst go-home segments for a pay-per-view main event that I have ever seen. So much so that people were leaving before it even started. Apparently, they took the idea of a go-home segment a little too literally. Roman Reigns came to the ring, which was filled with tables and ladders and chairs. Oh, my. He proceeded to do exactly what they should not have him doing right now, which is a long, boring promo. He reminded us that it was at the TLC pay-per-view 3 years ago that the Shield had their very first match. A great match, by the way. He started climbing the ladder as he was talking. He's doing two things at once. Not a good idea. So he's climbing the ladder and he's talking and talking about how he had started from the bottom. You know, all of a sudden he's fucking Drake. He started from the bottom. He worked his way to the top. And let me tell you, whoever scripted that lie should be fucking fired on the spot. The fucking guy debuted by attacking John Cena in a pay-per-view main event. And then went on to wrestle mostly pay-per-view main events and main event matches on TV for the next year plus. Started from the bottom. Who writes this shit? Now Roman was on top of the ladder, and he threatened to stay there until Sheamus came out, which he did. They bickered back and forth for what felt like eternity. Sheamus just refused to get into the ring. He was all the plunder that was inside, I know you're going to use it against me, I'm not getting in that ring, he said. He would not get in until Roman got rid of all the ladders and all the tables and all the chairs. Exciting, right? Isn't this exciting? Doesn't this sound exciting? All you people that don't watch Raw anymore, I bet you're jealous. I bet you're jealous you missed this. Doesn't this just make you giddy to see these two wrestle tonight? Well, what's that? Huh? You mean you're not excited? Three hours and 10 minutes into the show? You're not excited to see Sheamus stalling and stalling and stalling because Roman won't remove a table from the ring? You know, that may have been the thing that pissed me off the most now that I think about it. Why was this show still on the air at 11:10 p.m.? My clock said 11:10, and this segment was still going on. Did they really need to go overtime? Really? 3 hours and 5 minutes, not enough? Then came the line of the night from Roman Reigns. He said, I thought you Irishmen had potatoes. Looks like all you're smuggling is some tater tots. And then he proceeded to laugh at his own joke. And what's worse is that the crowd started a tater tots chant. And that was the moment, I think, when I realized, I think I may be too old for this shit. I've become Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon. That's what I've become. It broke my heart to hear that chant. It really did. Roman went on to say tater tots another 4 or 5 times, because that's the new chant now they're going to try to get over. Sheamus still would not get into the ring. Piece by piece, Roman would take furniture and toss it. I was ready to toss some furniture myself. He's tossing furniture from the ring to try to convince Sheamus to come inside. At no point did he try to go outside to get Sheamus and just say, fuck this, and go out there and kick his ass. No, he's taking the table out of the ring. Take the chair out of the ring. Takes the ladder out of the ring. He did exactly as he was asked. And they finally had a big brawl, but you know what? I'm not even going to recap what happened. It's not worth my time. One of the saddest images I've seen is when Roman was on top of the ladder, even before the tater tots line. Sheamus's music hits, and it looks like Reigns thinks the camera is off of him. He just has this exasperated expression on his face, like he knew he was dying out there, and there was nothing he could do about it. So that's it. That's all I have to say about this show. You know, the first hour was fine, and after that, it just fell off a cliff. And I'll tell you what, I think 15% thumbs up is being kind.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
This was the go-home show to Take Over London, which takes place this Wednesday. Going to do predictions after this review. Very much looking forward to that show, much more than I am TLC. Triple H did his usual pre-takeover conference call. He said 3 hours of Raw is too much sometimes. 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 He said the type of guy that he is, he looks at his watch after 2 hours of a movie. And so he recognized people are frustrated with Raw right now, and he admitted they don't really know how to fix it. Which is very encouraging, by the way, to hear that. But he does say they're working on it. Well, that's nice to know. He also said he pretty much shot down the idea of giving NXT the first hour of Raw. I've had a lot of you guys ask me that in mailbag questions over the last several months. Should they just give the 8 p.m. hour to NXT? And it's something I've said before I really don't think would work. I'm not really enamored with the idea just because I just don't think it would work. And I don't want to do anything that might weaken NXT. I think associating Raw with NXT right now would almost be, you know, death for NXT. But there's probably a lot of good reasons why they don't do it. I don't think Triple H really got into them on the conference call, but he didn't really sound too gung-ho about the idea either. So those were some of the takeaways from the call. But the go-home show this past week, Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy, they opened the show against Corey Hollis and John Skyler. A very different Enzo and Kaz than we're used to seeing. Carmella, too. They all had very serious, pissed-off expressions on their faces, very focused, very determined. They didn't do their usual opening shtick, and they just went out there for 3 minutes and dominated their opponents. Rocket launcher finish for the win. They took the mic after the match. Each guy cut a very serious promo on their opponents at TakeOver, Dash and Dawson. They promised to walk out of London the new NXT Tag Team Champions. I like this serious side to them. And not every week, but when it's warranted, I think it can be very effective. And this is actually a great example of something else that Triple H got asked on that conference call, now that I think of it. Someone asked him, why is it that on NXT, guys get angry, whereas on the main roster, they're always very happy and smiling no matter what happens? Which is a very valid question. And Triple H made it very clear, which I thought was funny, he has control over NXT and not the main roster. He was very clear in that. But it's absolutely true. You know, on Raw, how many times have we seen the babyface lose their championship, their world championship, and then come out all smiling and jokey the next night, right? John Cena does it all the time. They did it with Sheamus the night after he lost the world title to Big Show a few years ago. And they did it with Samoan Cena the night after Survivor Series this year. So we see it all the freaking time. It's one of the things I like about NXT, those little things that they tend to get right. Asuka murdered Deonna Purrazzo in a short match. Dana Brooke and Emma walked out on stage in the middle of her match. They tried to distract her, I guess, but it didn't work. Instead, Asuka hit poor Deonna with a spin kick of death, knocking her out and winning by ref stoppage. I love this woman. I love Asuka. It's not just that she's a great wrestler and she's got great facial expressions and she's cute and all that kind of stuff. Her outfits, even her outfits and her robe when she comes out, they're all so colorful. She's like a Japanese version of Macho Man with a vagina. I love this woman. The Hype Bros beat Blake and Murphy. Didn't do much for me. I mean, just kind of there. Neither team is even on the TakeOver card, so nothing really to get into here. Blake and Murphy continue to lose. Don't drink and drive, kids. Just don't drink and drive. Samoa Joe and Baron Corbin did a promo backstage where they looked directly into the camera when addressing their opponents, Finn Balor and Apollo Crews, in the main event tonight. My heart skipped a beat. I was so happy to see that. Joe admitted right off the bat they don't like each other, because remember, Joe and Corbin have had issues before they've wrestled. But tonight, they're going to work together to beat the hell out of Balor and Crews before TakeOver. Joe was great. Corbin was great. This was great. Bayley beat Peyton Royce. Peyton got a ton of offense in during this match. She looked pretty damn good in there. She could be the next breakout star in that women's. They're calling them divas now. Fuck that shit. They're women. So I think Peyton Royce could be the next breakout star in that women's division. She did fall in this match, though, to the belly to Bayley. Out comes Nia Jax and the big red heat machine, Eva Marie. Eva can barely speak because the crowd is booing her so loudly. I mean, this is like Vicky Guerrero-type heat. It's just, she couldn't even get a word in edgewise. Nia cuts her off, though, when she does start talking and says, I could do my own talking. And then she tells Bayley that she's going to take the title from her in London. Actually, the crowd booed just as loud for Nia Jax, too. I have to give her some credit. Although, I don't know how much credit she deserves. It's either she's really gotten over as a heel, which I don't think she's that good yet, or anyone who associates themselves in any way, shape, or form with Eva Marie is immediately just as hated. I'm going to go with door number two on that one. Backstage, Apollo Crews confronted his partner tonight, Finn Balor, about not returning his calls during the week. Are they dating? I don't know. I mean, who calls anybody anymore? Send him a fucking tweet. He reminds him that they have some unfinished business of their own, and that after TakeOver, he's coming for Finn's NXT title. We got a video package showing Sami Zayn swinging his arms around like a madman before his match with John Cena and injuring himself. Hopefully he's learned his lesson. Do jumping jacks or something when you get overly excited. Main event was Corbin and Joe against Balor and Cruz. Match built to Finn Balor finally getting the hot tag coming in against Samoa Joe. Finn ran wild for a little bit. Joe got him up for the muscle buster, but Balor slipped out, got a near fall. Balor went up top for the coup de grace. Baron Corbin shoves him off. And there was a weird jump cut here where it looked like Joe maybe... It looked like Joe caught him and, or was supposed to catch him maybe for a urinage, that urinage that he does, but instead kind of cut away, and then we saw Joe instead delivering an attitude adjustment to Finn Balor. So something must have gotten fucked up there. Cruz and Corbin, they brawl to the back, so they're out of it. Joe locks in the clutch, and for the second, or maybe the third, I've lost track now, for the third time maybe, he choked out the NXT champion. And Joe grabs the title. He poses over Finn's dead body to close the show. A fine way to go in to take over this Wednesday from London, England. 3 p.m. Eastern start time. Remember, it's early. Remember what I said about spoilers, too. If something gets spoiled for you, you've got nobody to blame but yourself. Don't go bitching about it. Stay the hell off social media and all wrestling websites on Wednesday if you're not watching the show until later that night. That's what I'm doing. And speaking of TakeOver, we may as well get right into it here. We did predictions earlier for TLC. Let's do predictions for a show that I am actually looking forward to, which is TakeOver from London. Sami Zayn, by the way, he may or may not be making an appearance on the show. They haven't officially announced it yet. All we know is that he is wrestling that night, but his return match, I believe, is being taped to air the following week. So usually when they go, like they went to Brooklyn, they tape TV that aired the following week to get a little more out of it. They're doing the same thing in London. And it sounds like Sammy's first match back will be the following week on NXT. But he'd probably come out for an interview or something, I would think. And by the way, I think they're crazy if they don't open this TakeOver show with William Regal. You know, they did with Triple H in Brooklyn. Triple H did the big announcement at the beginning of the show. I think because they're in England and because he's the general manager and hasn't been on TV in several weeks because he had surgery, I think they need to open the show with William Regal standing in the ring or maybe give him an entrance. And let him introduce the show. I think it would be appropriate to open that way. We have Emma against Asuka. This has the potential and should by all rights be Asuka's best match since she came to NXT. I mean, Dana Brooke surprised a lot of people. They had a good match. But other than that, Asuka, you know, she's been killing people. She hasn't really had that one big breakout performance yet. Emma is really good. We just haven't seen a lot of that lately. Although I've enjoyed the Evil Emma character. But in terms of Emma going out there and having a reasonably long, good wrestling match, we haven't really seen that in a while. I think this is going to be good, and I think Asuka, you know, has to win here. So Asuka's my pick. Apollo Crews and Baron Corbin. I'm going to go with Apollo Crews. I'm a big fan of both guys' work. More so Corbin, maybe, of late. I've warmed to Corbin. But I think Apollo Crews is going to get the win. Dash and Dawson against Kaz and Enzo for the Tag Team Championship. Look, I said before, I think they missed the boat by not putting the titles on them in Brooklyn. I think that would have been the place to do it. I still feel that way because they did cool off a little bit. They've been trying to build them back up. They've got to pull the trigger. I mean, this is it. Like, this is it. If they don't win the titles here, then they're not winning the titles. So they have to do a tag team title change, as far as I'm concerned, and they should. And Kaz and Enzo were my pick to win the belts. We have Bayley and Nia Jax for the NXT Women's Championship. This was a tough one to call. You know, this whole card, I mean, I have to say, you know, when you really look up and down the card, there's a bunch of matches here that really could go either way. It wasn't easy to just, like, immediately predict who's going to win this, who's going to win that. TLC, I think, and maybe I'll be wrong and my predictions will all be wrong for the pay-per-view tonight, but I looked at that card and I said, all right, this guy's winning, this guy's winning, this guy's winning. I look at the TakeOver card and it's a lot harder. So maybe, again, that goes to the booking of the two products. There's a message there. I think there's a message in there somewhere. This is a tough match to call between Bayley and Nia Jax. You know, on the one hand, since Bayley got rid of Sasha Banks, she vanquished Sasha Banks from NXT. She has taken on much of the women's roster already. She's beaten Alexa Bliss. She beat Eva Marie. She's beaten Peyton Royce, who's one of the up-and-coming stars in the division. If she keeps the title, you know, the question becomes, who's really left other than Eva Marie again? Because I still think Eva Marie is probably getting that belt. I mean, I don't see Carmella getting a title shot anytime soon. So it would make sense, I think, if it, on the one hand, if they took the title off of Bayley and had her chase and try to get it back. But, having said that, sometimes what makes sense isn't what ends up happening. I'm sticking with my gut. I still feel Bayley is retaining and keeping that championship. You know, maybe it'll end up being a DQ or a screwy finish or Eva gets involved. But I think Bayley is going to leave London with the title. I would laugh, though, if Eva helped Nia win the title and then Nia just kind of handed the belt to her for like a payoff, the way that Andre did with DiBiase back in 88 with Hogan. You know, if they do, hopefully Nia doesn't call it the tag team title like Andre did back then. And the main event, Finn Balor and Samoa Joe for the NXT Championship. I said either last week or the week before, I think last week I said that Samoa Joe ought to get the belt. He has impressed me so much of late. I have been very pleasantly surprised by Samoa Joe in NXT. He's reminded me a lot of the Joe of old from the early days of TNA or his run, you know, in ROH. He's motivated. You know, he's slimmer than he was the last we saw him in TNA. And he's really taken, you know, since they turned him heel, this guy's been a vicious fucking monster. He's been booked like a vicious fucking monster on this brand. And it suits him very well. And I think him and Balor are going to tear the fucking house down. I think they're going to have a great match. I want Joe to win, and I think he's going to win. I'm going to go and predict Samoa Joe wins the NXT Championship. Now, I don't know if they're going to go all the way where Hideo Itami comes back and then he points the finger at Joe and we find out Joe was the one who attacked him, and then it leads to a Joe and Itami program, which opens the door for Balor maybe to debut in the Rumble and go to the main roster. That's the way I would go with it. But whatever happens, I think Samoa Joe is winning the championship, and I hope he does. I really do. I mean, Balor, I like Finn Balor. I don't have anything against him. He's a great wrestler, and he's got the great entrance, and I agree with a lot of you guys. I've exchanged emails with some of you about whether or not he ought to change things up with the Demon. Right? There's really nothing other than the body paint that separates Finn and the Demon. Right? I mean, the Demon doesn't speak and he's got body paint, but other than that, they're one and the same. Same moveset, same wrestling style. Nothing really changes. I'm with a lot of you in that I think he ought to differentiate the Demon from Finn, give the Demon a couple of moves that Finn never does, maybe even make the Demon a little more heelish, just to change things up a little bit. Maybe we'll see that on this show, I don't know, but yeah, the fact is Joe is just tearing it up right now, and this may be as far as it goes for him, because apparently they have no plans to call him up to the main roster. So if this is as good as it gets, I say give him the belt and give him a nice run. There's no reason not to do it. Ring of Honor. Ring of Honor TV. I get it on the internet now. It's a wonderful thing, this internet. You can find almost anything on there. Even porn, that's what I've heard. Not that I would have any experience with that, but Ring of Honor is the next best thing. By the way, before I even get into this, I have to mention Adam Cole. Adam Cole returned to PWG Friday night as a member of the Mount Rushmore heel faction that they have going there in the promotion. The Young Bucks were on the show, and they've been doing a deal, I guess, with a dragon and a mask or something. I'm not hip to everything that's been going on with PWG storylines, but I know Adam Cole used to be there. He signed an exclusive contract a while back with Ring of Honor. He wasn't allowed to go to PWG, and all of a sudden, he unmasks, and holy shit, it's Adam Cole. Adam Cole is still with Ring of Honor. He's still under contract. Apparently, there's now some kind of working agreement between the two where they will allow certain Ring of Honor talents to appear on PWG shows if as long as it doesn't conflict with Ring of Honor shows, which I think is reasonable. So that was a nice surprise for people in the building. That's one place I actually would love to go to one day. I have no idea when it could possibly even happen, but they have these shows in that little tiny building there in Reseda, California. Even if I could make it out there, I mean, it'd be impossible to get tickets. They sell out every freaking time. They only fit like 400 people in that building. But that may be the closest thing to like the old ECW arena that you got going. I mean, you know, Full Sail to a degree, I guess, is kind of like that. You get a lot of the same people and all the weird chants, and you know, they have a certain respect, I think, for the in-ring product. It's the closest thing, you know, that you can think of to what used to be the old ECW, but this PWG shit in that building and receipt of that, even more than NXT, is probably closer to what ECW... I say ECW, I don't mean, like, necessarily the product itself, but just the, like, the hardcore fan base and going to that same building, small building, probably gets very hot in there, not the most pleasant place to be in, but everybody's having fun. That's what wrestling should be. And one of these days, I'd love to be able to get out there, but again, probably impossible to get tickets. Final Battle is this Friday on pay-per-view. I hear there's some big new movie coming out on Friday as well, but I can't bring myself to give a shit. I watched the previous week's Ring of Honor that I missed, so I'm all caught up now on my ROH. Red Dragon against Silas Young and the Beer City Bruiser. Open the show. I don't know why. I just love the Beer City Bruiser. And I love Silas, too. I think both of them, they're throwbacks to another time in wrestling. Or maybe I'm just so sick and fucking tired of seeing the same shit in WWE that I get nostalgic for a fucking 400-pound guy when he comes out smoking a stogie and drinking beer. I don't know. Whatever it is, I like the act. I hope they keep doing it. They had the boys, Dalton Castle's boys, with them, carrying a beer keg to the ring. Some good action here in this match, chasing the dragon to the Bruiser for the win. Silas had the boys attack the referee. I think it was Paul Turner. After the match, Dalton Castle came out, and he told Silas that he wanted his boys back. Very homoerotic, this entire segment here. And they teased. The boys got up on the apron. They teased they were going to go back with Dalton. And then they had second thoughts. And they decided they wanted to stay with Silas. So apparently he has succeeded in corrupting Dalton's boys. Chris Sabin came to the ring. He said that he was holding the show hostage until the mystery man in the red mask who's been attacking people came out to reveal himself. People kept thinking it was Sabin. Obviously it wasn't. He wanted the person to come out and to reveal themselves, and out came Red Mask, who revealed himself to be Alex Shelley, his former Motor City Machine Guns tag team partner. Shelley has, of course, been teaming with Kushida in New Japan for some time now as the Time Splitters. Sabin had a very perplexed look on his face, and he bailed. So, little cliffhanger there. What is Alex Shelley doing back in Ring of Honor? Roderick Strong defended his TV title against a newcomer by the name of Samson Walker, who is a big boy, every bit of 280, 290. This is part of a gimmick they're doing where it's Roddy versus the world, they're calling, or Roddy versus. I keep saying verse. It's not verse. It's versus. Stop doing that. I just slapped myself. That was the noise you heard. It's Roddy versus the world because he wants to prove that he is a fighting champion. That's the gimmick. Bobby Fish of Red Dragon came back out to do commentary as he is the one challenging Roddy for the TV title at Final Battle. And this was weird because Red Dragon is a babyface tag team, very beloved by the crowd. But Fish was really healing it up here during this match. The other thing I noticed listening to him on commentary is that Bobby Fish sounds like a dead ringer for Dolph Ziggler. I don't know if I'm the only one that noticed that, but go back and close your eyes and pretend that it's Dolph and listen, and I bet you'll think the same thing. At one point during the match, Samson Walker pulled out an asthma inhaler from his singlet and took a puff. Hopefully it was asthma medicine in that canister. I don't know if that's supposed to be his gimmick or if he really does have asthma. ROH, I think, needs to get their wellness policy up to par here. Gutbuster, sick kick by Roddy for the win. Bobby Fish strapped the TV title around his own waist and got in the ring and taunted Roddy by posing with it. And Roddy ripped it off his waist. A bunch of referees came in to separate them. Main event was the Young Bucks against the Briscoes. This was a lot of fun. This was the polar opposite, the complete and polar opposite of the so-called main event that we saw last Monday night. This was a real main event. The All Night Express were on commentary, or at least Kenny King was. Rhett Titus was, I guess they didn't have any chair, so he was forced to stand like a moron, and whenever he spoke, I could barely hear what he was saying. He'd have to bend over and lean in and try to talk into Kenny King's headset. Super kicks galore, as you could imagine. I'm sure that pisses off a whole bunch of people, but who cares? You know what I love about it? I love the ones that I don't see coming. It's like, you think you're getting the upper hand on these guys in the match, and then just boom, they kick you in the face. Case in point, there's a spot here where Mark Briscoe went for the Cactus Jack elbow off the apron. But on his way down, the other buck kicked him in the face. Came out of nowhere and just kicked him in the face on the way down. The Briscoes gave Nick Jackson a doomsday device. Nick flipped, though, on the way down, landed on his feet. And, of course, what else? He hit a super kick. Indy Taker only got a near fall, but then the Young Bucks hit more bang for your buck and got the win. A fun match. Find it. Watch it. My words do not do it justice. Not match of the year or anything like that, but just a lot of great moves, a lot of fun, a lot of action. All Night Express got into the ring afterward. It broke down into a giant brawl with all three teams as they went off the air. Next week, they said Jerry Lynn is back. Not wrestling, because he's retired, so, you know, why he's back, they didn't say. But he is back, and ACH will team with Matt Sydal to take on Roppongi Vice from New Japan. AJ Styles, by the way, should be good to go for his match with Jay Lethal at Final Battle this Friday. He has some herniated discs in his back, which is not fun. I'll make one prediction for Final Battle without going through the whole card because I don't have it in front of me, but that is the main event. I predict that Jay Lethal is going to retain his championship in that match. Seems pretty obvious to me anyway that he is. I don't think he's losing the world title so soon after dropping the TV title. You've got all the questions about AJ's health with his back. And also, Lethal is supposed to defend that title at, I think he's supposed to defend it against, is it Michael Elgin? Or I guess Elgin and Moose are having a match at Final Battle. It'll probably be Elgin who goes over. But Jay Lethal is defending that title at Wrestle Kingdom. He's defending the Ring of Honor title, I think for the first time ever, that championship is being defended at Wrestle Kingdom at the Tokyo Dome, which is a big deal. And on that same show, AJ Styles is already booked. Hopefully he's able to make the booking. He's already booked for a match with Nakamura. So, again, when you really think about this, they're not taking that title off Jay Lethal. There was actually a photo on Twitter that I saw of AJ at DDP's new performance center that he has, this new DDP Yoga Performance Center down in Georgia. So, you know, he may be turning to yoga to help heal his back. I don't know. Speaking of DDP, perfect segue into this week's ginormous mailbag. This is just a gigantic mailbag that we have here. And please keep sending in your questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I got a message from Russell asking me why DDP reached out to me on Twitter last month. And he's not the only person who's asked me about that, so I wanted to address it here up front and just be done with it. For those who don't know, Diamond Dallas Page reached out to me on Twitter last month. A lot of you saw it and thought maybe it had something to do with his yoga stuff, becoming a sponsor or something. It had nothing to do with any of that. What it was he asked for my phone number. I gave it to him. He called me. We had a great conversation, really positive. He had some very nice things to say about the show. It had mostly to do, though, with the Jake Roberts documentary, The Resurrection of Jake the Snake. And without getting into all the specifics, he and the director of the film asked me to write something for them, which I was honored they thought of me, and I agreed to do it. I got it over to them the day after Thanksgiving, once the holiday rush died down, and I have not heard a single thing from them since. Completely blew me off. I have no idea what happened. I direct messaged Dallas on Twitter a few days later just to make sure he got the original email. I said, oh, there's an attachment. Should I put it in the body? Maybe he didn't get it. So I sent him the DM. No response. I called him when I was laid out with the flu. I got his voicemail, left him a message. No response. And that was over 2 weeks ago. And it's too late now anyway, you know, for the article, but that still doesn't explain why nobody got back to me. You know, maybe they were playing a joke on me. It seems kind of far-fetched, I don't know, but maybe they were. I mean, if so, I have absolutely no idea what would possess them to do that, but all I'm left to assume is, you know, the joke's on me. It's just all very disappointing, more than anything else. I don't have a bad word to say about what DDP is doing with his yoga stuff. You know, he's changing people's lives. He did it with Jake. Although, after that video he uploaded about Bray Wyatt, I'm not so sure what's going on there. But, you know, he did it with him. He did it with Scott Hall. He's done it with many people listening to this podcast. Some of you guys have raved about DDP Yoga. You've posted before and after photos on our Facebook page. You know, maybe WWE ought to make it mandatory for all their performers to do with all these injuries that they've had. As far as the documentary, I stand by what I said in my review a couple of months ago after I saw it in the theater. It was a great movie, and I hope everybody ends up seeing it. You know, one bad experience here for me does not change any of that. Dallas did share something very cool with me when we talked on the phone about where the movie may be airing soon, but I don't know if that's public knowledge or if he wants that out yet, so I'm not going to say anything. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. I wrote it, I sent it over to them as they asked, and it all went to waste without so much as an email back. That, to me, is the most puzzling part. It's just very disappointing. Just not really much else to say about it. Jay from Atlanta, I am sure you remember the WWE vs. Parents Television Council battle back in 1999-2000. What do you recall from that, and do you remember how it ended? Oh, I remember. Oh, I remember it. I remember they targeted SmackDown because it aired on broadcast TV, and they said the show was indecent, and some little kids at the time were... There was some case about a kid who supposedly used a wrestling move and killed another kid. And what happened is, you know, the PTC, they ended up chasing away a whole bunch of WWF sponsors, including, ironically, Coca-Cola, who I noticed as of last Monday is now, after all these years, back in bed with WWE. Although I guess USA is the one who probably got them, because I think the way the agreement works is, you know, WWE doesn't really handle the sponsor stuff. I think that's something USA goes out and gets. So with this K Jewelers and now Coca-Cola, I think that's something that's being done on USA's end. But yeah, Coke was maybe the biggest sponsor that they had chased away all those years ago. And the reason I remember that is because at the time I was doing my column for the local newspaper here in Brooklyn. I was doing an internship, and I was doing a wrestling column. I was the first one to do a wrestling column for the newspaper. And I even shared with you guys on Twitter a few months ago. I was going through some old stuff here, and I came across the very first piece of hate mail, which at the time was not email, it was physical. Somebody had to go through the trouble of typing this on a typewriter because it was two old people. And they typed up the letter, and I know this because they, you know, it's obvious that it was like an old couple who wrote me the letter. They were just appalled by something I said. I was defending Vince McMahon from something that Phil Mushnick had written in the New York Post, and they took great offense to this, and they wrote to the paper addressed to me to complain and to say that I was a bad person, and it was great. I smiled. I take so much pride in that letter. I kept it. This, you know, 15 years, I still have that letter. But I was following the whole PTC thing because that was happening right around the same time. So it's very interesting to see how that all unfolded, and it didn't turn out very well for the PTC because... Well, the main reason is they lied through their fucking teeth with a lot of the shit they said about WWE. I mean, there was an argument to be made about, you know, some of the things that WWF was doing at the time, but the PTC just lied through their freaking teeth. They got nailed. WWE sued them, and they won a judgment of a few million dollars, and the PTC was forced to publicly apologize. So in the end, Vince McMahon won. That's also where the right to censor came from. It was a spoof on the PTC. Jeremy wants to know my thoughts on Vince Russo's comments about Kevin Owens. You know, I saw the video on YouTube. Somebody sent me a link. I don't know if it's from a recent show or months ago. I don't know. But Russo had some not-so-nice things to say about Kevin Owens. He called him fat. He said that he would never draw money, which I thought was comical. He said he'll never draw money in WWE, which... It's surprising to me because from everything I've read, it sure seems like he's selling a shit ton of merchandise, which, you know, Vince Russo, you would think of all people, would know is probably one of the most motivating factors to Vince McMahon. That's probably one of the most important things, even more than how you can work in the ring. You know, how many t-shirts can you sell? Judging by how many new t-shirts Kevin Owens keeps getting, about 857 of them, I'd say he's probably doing pretty well right now. He's going to be catching up to Cena soon in terms of the number of t-shirts he has. Yeah, but then he went and said, you know, he doesn't even think he's a good worker. He's slow. He doesn't see his work. You know, when he said that, I realized either he's just trolling or he's really just that stupid. And I hope now, after that, that people will kind of see this guy for how he is and really just not pay any attention when he says stuff like that. Because how can you take somebody like that seriously? I mean, it's okay to have a point of view that says, well, I don't really like this guy. He's not a favorite of mine. Or, you know, the one thing I will say, he did say when you look at Kevin Owens, you don't see a superstar. If, like, the average fan or a non-wrestling fan were to look at Kevin Owens as compared to, like, a John Cena or a Randy Orton, they would look at this guy and be like, yeah, he looks like my dad, or he doesn't look like a superstar. You know, fine, I'll give him that. Kevin Owens is a pretty normal-looking guy. He comes out, cut-off t-shirt, basketball shorts, sure. But that doesn't mean that somebody like him can't be successful and can't make money and be a top guy in WWE. I expect that he's going to be. To me, he's already one of the bigger stars they have. And to say, well, he'll never draw money and he doesn't know how to work. You know, when you start to say stuff like that, it's like only the internet fans or only the indie wrestling fans like Kevin Owens and think that he's going to be a top guy. It's, again, funny to me when I watch Raw any given week or a pay-per-view, Kevin Owens comes out, his music hits. Generally speaking, he gets one of the louder reactions, whether it's boos, whether it's cheers. And we're not talking just in New York, or just in Chicago, or just in LA, or just in Philadelphia. This is all over. Get some pretty good reactions. I remember reading, you know, when he was feuding with Cena. Now, Cena does pretty well when it comes to house show business. You know, you look at the numbers and drawing 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people. When Owens was feuding with Cena, because they had a house show program going for a while, you know, it looked like it was actually doing pretty good business. It was probably doing better than most of the house show programs that John Cena does with different people. People were coming out, they were buying a ticket to go to the show to see John Cena and Kevin Owens in the main event. WWE kept putting them in those main events. Again, do you think they would be doing that if this guy wasn't drawing them some money? Does he not get any credit for that at all? So when you make stupid blankets that only the internet fans like Kevin Owens, he doesn't know how to work, yeah, the guy's a clown, and hopefully people see him for what he is. It's just, when I heard that, Vince Russo, it's just amazing to me. It's like, I watched that whole video, including the end where he pitched his own idea for how to get Kevin Owens over, and it's like, bro, Kevin, let me tell you something, bro, okay? I'm going to be perfectly honest with you, bro. Okay? Bro, listen, bro. Kevin Owens will never, ever, 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 ever draw money in WWE. Bro, it's not going to happen. Look at him. Look at him, bro. Look at this guy. The guy's fat. He's got fat rolls. Fans are looking at him going, who is this guy? I can't believe in a guy like this, and this guy is going to make money in WWE? Bro, are you kidding me? Bro, I got a great idea for Kevin Owens. I got the mother of all ideas for Kevin Owens. This is Vince Russo's secret sauce, okay? Because my Italian roots, we got the secret sauce here for Kevin Owens. And look, bro, nobody knows how to make stars like Vince Russo. Look, bro, 18 years ago, look at all the stars that I helped make 18 years ago. Haven't done much since, but, you know, back then, bro, Stone Cold Steve Austin, okay? Bro, if it wasn't for Vince Russo, there would be no Stone Cold Steve Austin, okay? Look at The Rock, bro, okay? Look at The Rock. The Rock owes Vince Russo his entire movie career. Okay, because he had one conversation with Vince Russo. Vince Russo was telling him what to say, and now The Rock, he's some big movie star. Okay, bro, who do you think gave him that break? It was Vince Russo. Look at all the stars that I'm... Where would TNA? Where would TNA be today without Vince Russo? They would be dead. Okay, bro, they would be dead. TNA went to this Pop TV or whatever it's called. And bro, look, the way things went down with me and Dixie Carter, I, I'm not a bitter guy. I'm not a bitter guy. But, you know, I sent her a tweet congratulating her on the new TV deal. And bro, it doesn't bother me, but, you know, I noticed that JR sent Dixie Carter a tweet congratulating her on her new TV deal. And Dixie Carter publicly responded to JR and thanked him. She thanked JR. What did JR ever do for TNA? She didn't thank Vince Russo publicly. Now, she did tweet me back to say, you know, I did thank you privately, which is true. I mean, look, bro, it didn't bother me, even though I did tweet her back and say, well, I guess I'm not JR. But she did tweet me privately. But let's face facts. She should have tweeted me publicly, because she owes me all of TNA. If it wasn't for me, there would be no TNA. So they have their little TV deal, and bro, I'm happy, okay? I'm not bitter. I'm happy I have friends who still work for TNA. I don't know if they're going to be alive in 3 months or not, because I'm not there anymore, but best of luck to TNA. Vince McMahon's company is going down the tubes. I sent him an email. He didn't email me back. It probably ended up in spam, but whatever. Bro, if Vince McMahon wants Vince Russo to come in and save his company, he knows how to reach me. There is only one person in the world who can save WWE or TNA, and you're looking at him. There is nobody else on the earth, bro, who can do it but me. So I'm going to do WWE a favor. I am going to give them the greatest idea in the world for Kevin Owens. If you want to make money with this guy, you've got to make him the son of Adrian Adonis. Okay, bro? And by the way, Adrian Adonis, another guy that Vince Russo made. You won't hear that side of the story because WWE doesn't want you to know that. But when I was a kid, I would phone ideas into them. Bro, Adrian Adonis, all my idea. But that's beside the point. Kevin Owens needs to be the son of Adrian Adonis. Kevin Adonis. Bro, it is a license to print money. Otherwise, this guy is not going to go anyway. He's going to be a footnote. He'll be a pizza delivery guy in 5 years without Vince Russo, bro. And he doesn't know how to work. Disco Inferno, that's a worker. So if WWE ever wants to give me a ring, I would be more than happy to come in and to do what I can to help Kevin. Look, you don't even have to pay. I'll pay for my own airfare. No, seriously, I got nothing else going on. Bro, call me. I will come in. We will make a ton of money. It'll be like it's 1999 all over again, bro. Kevin Owens, I'm telling you, the son of Adonis. We'll give him the flower shop. We'll make him a florist. That's enough of this. Oh, my God. And yet the sad part is, all of that, everything I just said, I don't doubt for a second that he probably believes most of it. Chuck, from Big Rock, Illinois. What do you think the legacy is for Mick Foley? I've heard him described as a legend of the industry and very underrated as a performer. I've heard him described as the most successful enhancement talent of all time by making Shawn Michaels, Triple H, Rock, Sting, and Randy Orton look tougher. And Ric Flair has described him as a glorified stuntman. All of these may be true, and in my opinion, he is one of the best in-ring storytellers of all time. But I'm not sure where he would fit into the history of WWE as a whole. What do you think the legacy of Mick Foley is? I think Mick Foley will go down as the greatest overachiever in WWE history. You know, he's all of those things that you just mentioned. He is a legend. He is underrated in some ways as a performer. He was something of an enhancement guy. Well, if you consider an enhancement guy to be somebody who actually enhances the other person he's in the ring with, then yes, he was one of the greatest enhancement guys, because he made others look good, and he made them look tough by hanging with him because, you know, those hardcore matches he was so well known for. A guy like a Randy Orton taking that thumbtack bump at Backlash, that was a big moment in his career. And to an extent, he probably is a glorified stuntman. I mean, I could see where he would be offended by Flair saying that. It's not the first time Ric Flair has said something that has offended or rankled somebody. But he's an overachiever. You know, who in their right mind ever would have thought that this guy would end up as WWE champion, let alone WWE champion three times over? And a best-selling author, and all of the things that this guy has done, nobody would have expected that. Just based on the way he looks, it goes against everything that Vince McMahon, I'm sure, believes a top superstar should look like. And that'd be fair to Vince McMahon, probably most wrestling promoters. They probably would not look at, you know, Mankind and then look at a guy like a Lex Luger or a Sting or a Randy Orton and gravitate toward Mankind. So it just goes against, you know, what they would believe in. But he was able to make a connection with the fans, and when you make that connection, generally the fans will dictate how far you go. You know, same thing with Daniel Bryan, small guy, not their image of what a top guy or what a world champion should look like, but god damn it, you know, the people love that guy, and they helped elevate him to a level that he never would have gotten to otherwise. If the fans didn't shut up about him in 2013, at the beginning of 2014, even after CM Punk walked out, they would have just found somebody else to plug into that spot. You think Daniel Bryan would have been their first choice if it wasn't for all the uproar from the fans? Of course not. They would have gone with somebody else. Any number of people on the roster they would have picked over him. Mick Foley was the first person to make The Undertaker look mortal. I remember that. I said this a few weeks ago. Somebody asked me, what is Undertaker's greatest rivalry, or who is his greatest rival? And I said, it's Mankind. Undertaker's had a lot of, you know, great rivals in WWE. Of course, Kane and Shawn Michaels. And you can name, you know, even a few other people. You can name Austin if you want to, or Triple H. The answer is Mankind. And Mankind was the first person to come along that made The Undertaker look vulnerable and mortal. And he was the first guy to get the closest thing to a clean win over The Undertaker in that very first match they had at the King of the Ring in 96, and he beat him in the second match too, in the Boiler Room Brawl. I mean, that's just something that did not happen back then with The Undertaker. The Undertaker didn't get beat like that. He took three different characters, and he made all of them work, including Dude Love. Somehow, he made that work. I don't know how, but he did. You know, I love Mankind. Mankind, that was a great character. Dude Love was a joke, but he made it work. Headlined two pay-per-views against Steve Austin for the championship with that character. And you know my thoughts on that Over the Edge match. I fucking love that match. Cactus Jack. Cactus Jack was going to work anyway because it was already established. But, you know, he made all three characters work in WWE. I mean, there are guys that go through half a dozen gimmicks and they can't make any of them work. Feud with The Rock. Rock was already world champion by the time they started feuding, but he made The Rock look like the most sadistic son of a bitch on the planet in that I Quit match at the Royal Rumble. You know, Foley had no problem sacrificing himself to make others look good. He did it with Rock. He did it with Undertaker in that Hell in a Cell match. Maybe he had a death wish in that match. I don't know. He did it with Randy Orton. He did it with Edge at WrestleMania. Rock was very generous in terms of winning and losing. You know, Rock is, if he's not near the top, he is the top guy. Maybe him and Flair. When it comes to, like, this megastar who didn't seem to really, not that he didn't care, but, you know, there are guys that I'm not going to lose. They're very protective about their spot and how many times they lose and who they lose to. And I look at a guy like Flair, I look at a guy like Rock, Jericho, I think is kind of the same way, where, you know, they would lose quite a bit. I mean, maybe even more than they should have, quite frankly. But I don't know that there's ever been another top guy as giving to his opponents than Mick Foley. Not just, I don't mean like physically putting his body on the line, but like going out of his way to make them look good, to help get them to that next level when they needed it. Best example of that I can give is Triple H. Triple H was on the cusp in 99, you know, even after he already won the world championship. I didn't buy him as a real main eventer. He was always, it's always like Austin, Rock, Taker, and then like one step below, okay, Triple H, even when he had the belt. He wasn't on, you know, we had those guys, but he wasn't on their level. In another era, maybe it would have been a lot easier to accept him in that role, but, I mean, look at all the talent they had at the time. Triple H, I mean, he didn't stand a chance at the beginning of his run as, like, a real main eventer. Until he feuded with Mick Foley. And they had that street fight in 2000 at the Royal Rumble. You know, for me, that's the match that changed my entire view of Triple H. And then he beat Foley a second straight time. In the Hell in a Cell match, which I didn't like as much, but, you know, it wasn't a bad match, but I prefer the street fight. Foley, you know, Foley did for Triple H what Triple H later did for Batista. Which is why it always puzzled me that Triple H would not give Foley the credit that he deserved. You know, now he says wonderful things about him, but before, it almost seemed like he resented the idea that Mick Foley somehow helped make him who he is. Yeah, I never understood that. I'd be going out of my way to thank this fucking guy whenever I could if he did that for me. Now, Foley had some high-profile matches with guys like Vader and Sting and WCW, but you thought, okay, yeah, that's as far as it goes for a guy like him. You know, he went to ECW, he was a star there. But he came to WWE and he feuded with the big names like Undertaker and Shawn Michaels, and you thought, okay, that's his role, right? He gets in there, He's, I guess, technically a main eventer, but that's as far as it goes for him, right? This is his peak. He's peaked. But to see what he ended up accomplishing, I mean, how could he not be the biggest overachiever in the history of that company? I mean, sometimes you hear the word overachiever, it's used in a negative way. There is nothing negative about the way I'm using that word here. Let me just make that clear. It's just the way that company is. A guy like Mick Foley was never supposed to attain the level of success that he did, and this cult following that he has, it's amazing, you know. So I think overachiever and helping others, that's his legacy to me. He's not just the hardcore guy. I don't think that's fair to him to just call him the hardcore guy. He gave of himself to put other people over. He happened to get himself over in that process, which is even better. But think of all the shit that this guy did and put his body through and the bumps he took and everything else just to make it look better. It's like, this guy's out of his mind. And to this very day, he hasn't wrestled a match in years. Foley, still giving back to people, just in different ways. You know, the stuff he's done with Rain, that Rain organization, and other charities. He was doing something recently to help raise some money for older wrestlers that needed help with their medical bills. I know he was talking about that on Steve Austin's podcast. He's writing children's books. I mean, he leaves behind a better legacy than a lot of other names that are in that Hall of Fame right now. So I think at the end of the day, that's what his legacy is going to be, and I think that's great. Let's see here. Sean from Los Angeles is a short one, so we'll use this one. Hey, Solid Monster, No Holds Barred or Suburban Commando, which Hogan movie would you watch and feel less shame about watching? I like them both. They're guilty pleasures of mine. No Holds Barred is just so much more comically horrible. I just can't vote against it. Brell is such a great villain in that movie. So hateable. Goes around calling everybody jock ass for some reason. I mean, what's not to love? JC from Tampa. Seeing that John Cena's been off TV for a while, it got me thinking about what Cena might end up doing once he retires from wrestling. My opinion, I think he might end up sticking around and becoming an agent for WWE. I don't think that it is too far-fetched of an idea, given that Cena's been calling a majority of his own matches. I don't see him having a career in film like The Rock. And until we see some footage from American Grit, I don't see reality TV in his future either. Do you agree or disagree? I disagree. I don't see Cena as an agent in a suit and tie backstage. I don't see him in the Road Dogg or the Arn Anderson role. I'm not saying, you know, they wouldn't offer it to him. I just don't see him doing it. You know, he's going to make more movies. They may not be as big as the ones The Rock is in, but he's got a future in movies. He may have one hosting shows on TV like the way Steve Austin does. I think American Grit, I mean, whether it fails or not, you know, he could easily have a future hosting, you know, some reality shows. And really, he's already, if you think about it, he's already following The Rock's blueprint. He's involved in films. last year, I remember reading, I think it was in Variety, that Cena was starting his own production company outside of WWE to develop reality TV shows. You know, Rock's done that too, right? He had that show The Hero on TNT. So this all sounds very familiar to me. For the same reason that you don't see guys like Rock or Austin or Flair or Brett working behind the scenes as an agent, I don't see Cena doing it either. He's got plenty of other things he wants to do. And to be honest, you know, with his personality and his media savvy, you know, he's co-hosted the Today Show a few times recently. It would be a waste, I think, of the guy's talents to be relegated to an agent role backstage. So, no, I don't see that. June from Brooklyn. I was thinking that John Cena is just too big of a star to have the U.S. title, so I tried to think back to find if there was ever a big star that held a mid-card title that made it mean as much as Cena has with the U.S. championship. I would say Shawn Michaels' European title run in 1997 was much better because that rivalry and match with the British Bulldog was epic, and beating Bulldog for the title in Canada to me was better than Cena and his open challenge. What do you think, and can you think of any other examples of this? I don't know if I'd call it epic. I mean, they had one match. They were supposed to have a rematch with Bulldog getting the European belt back, but you know how that goes. I think in general, titles meant much more in 97 than they do today, at least in WWE. I mean, you know, Ring of Honor does a good job with their titles. So does New Japan. Yeah, even NXT, you know, I have to say, they try to make them really mean something, but it was a different world back in 97. First of all, they were in the UK, not Canada, if you're talking about that one-night-only pay-per-view. So they had a tremendous amount of heat for that match, and when Shawn won, you know, people were furious, and they were throwing trash at him, and he was also just a great dick, because, as they say, you know, the best characters are just your real-life personality turned up, and he was a dick back then. So it wasn't really a stretch for him to act like one. But, you know, you just don't get that kind of heat anymore in WWE. You just don't. It doesn't exist. And as a big part of the problem, I think, is that wins and losses don't matter. It's hard to care when you have Nikki Bella go out on television, and even she admitted it a few months ago. Wins and losses, who cares, right? Remember that great quote? Remember that? Except they do matter. You look at the Undertaker streak. People cared about that, didn't they? Look at Brock Lesnar. He rarely ever loses. And he's a big deal because of it. You know, I got an email from someone. I think it was James. I didn't use it on the show, but he was just ranting about how WWE has handled Bray Wyatt since WrestleMania last year. And he was asking me if I think Undertaker would have gone on to the legendary status that he has if WWE would have booked him in the early and like mid-90s. The way they do everybody else today, and just had him lose to everybody or win and then lose and win and then lose, you know, the even Steven 50-50. And I think Undertaker would still be regarded as a legend, and, you know, he'd be in the Hall of Fame eventually and all that. But, he, you know, James is right. I don't know that the Undertaker as a character would have gotten over nearly as big as he did if he lost as much as he won. Look how they protected that guy for the first few years. I mean, again, he had the greatest character in the world. They said to him, you go out there and just no-sell everything. I mean, come on. That's a fucking great gig. There aren't too many characters like The Undertaker. But they protected him in those early years. He almost never lost clean. He almost never lost, period. And when he did, it was usually by screw job. You know, now everybody wins a few, and then they lose a few, because it's almost like they're afraid to kill one guy at the expense of another. What they don't realize is they end up weakening both of them when they do that. Sometimes you gotta pick one over the other. Not everybody can be a winner. It's like this bullshit where everybody gets a fucking award, right? Or everybody gets a fucking medal. That's the new thing now. No. Not everybody gets an award, because not everybody deserves one. And it's like the same mentality in WWE. We got to protect everybody. And in trying to protect everybody, they protect no one. Except Roman and Cena. It doesn't work. So nobody ends up feeling special. Hey, think back to 97, right? You mentioned 1997. It's crazy to think. Here's a guy, Shawn Michaels. His whole mantra was, I don't lay down for anybody, except my friends. Bulldog was supposed to win that match in the UK. He pledged to his sister. His sister was dying of cancer, and she actually died, I think, a short time later. He pledged to his sister. He vowed he was going to win. And then he was told, well, actually, Sean's going to go over in this one. And it's like, what a fool that made him look like. But winning and losing was such a big deal. You know, here's this guy who said, I'm not going to lose to anyone. Look at Montreal. Look at what a big deal everybody made about who had the world title and how it would kill the company if this guy had the championship. All of that over who was the world champion. Imagine something like that happening today. Imagine how ridiculous that would be. Imagine behind the scenes Sheamus and Roman Reigns politicking over who was going to be the champion, as though it really means anything anymore. I mean, I like John Cena's open challenge gimmick. It was one of the only interesting things about Raw all of this year. But titles in general, it felt like a much bigger deal back then because everything, for the most part, was positioned as being a big deal. And as far as other examples of like a main event or like a top-line guy holding a mid-card title, and again, there may be some hardcore WCW fans who were much more into WCW back then than I was, and they may take me to task for saying this. I think TV title, I think, you know, easy mid-card title. Maybe at one time the television title was this very prestigious championship in WCW, but it's a mid-card title. The best example I could think of off the top of my head, Arn Anderson. People rave about that run or the runs he had with the TV title back then, like in the 80s, even the early 90s. I think he held the belt a whole bunch of times. I know Arn was never a world champion, but again, he felt like a big enough deal to where he would be above the TV title, so maybe that. Maybe Arn Anderson with the TV title is the best example I could give. I can't really think of any others right now. Ivan from San Diego. What was the point of putting Rocco the Ventriloquist dummy with the Legion of Doom in 1992? Do you think that was the beginning of the end for the Road Warriors as a dominant tag team? Oh, God. Rocco. Animal did an interview a few years back. I don't remember if it was a newspaper or a website or whatever. And he said, you know, Rocco was not done as a joke, according to him. I don't know about that. He says, you know, they did it to make them, like, more human or more sympathetic because the LOD, yeah, they were a very dominant team and they were steamrolling over people. And plus, they thought they would sell a bunch of those dolls. I'll tell you something right now. I would take an arena full of fucking unicorn horns before I would ever take an arena full of those dummies. Okay, those things freak me the fuck out. Can you imagine 10,000 of those things? A nightmare that would be. But I think Rocco ended up getting... They like, ditched him or they lost him in an airport or something. I'm sure accidentally. The Rocco thing was shit. The only dummy was whoever thought that would actually be a good idea. Was it the beginning of the end for them? Not really. I mean, they were done anyway because it was right after they introduced Rocco that Hawk walked out on the company. It was after SummerSlam at Wembley Stadium. They rode to the ring on motorcycles with that fucking doll strapped to the front of one of them. No wonder Hawk walked out. It wasn't a contract dispute or a money dispute. He disappeared in London and nobody knew where he was. And the fact is, if somebody stuck you with a doll named Rocco, you'd disappear in a coke binge too. Ahmed in Egypt. Why is there a problem between Jeff Jarrett and Vince McMahon? WWE has made up with many people, except for Jarrett, and I don't see them ever doing so. Can you please explain to me what happened to cause the problem between them? It isn't just any one thing, I don't think. I mean, Jarrett had disputes and left WWE a couple of different times. In 95, he walked out after he dropped the Intercontinental title, came back a few months later. He was maybe back for 2 months, if that, and then he disappeared again at the beginning of 96. He went to WCW after that, so I'm sure that created some... between the two departures and then him going to the competition... I'm sure that didn't endear him to Vince McMahon, although he did come back, right, in 99 is when he left. So he did come back and spend a little bit of time there before he left the third time. But in 99, that was really, I think, I won't say this is the only reason, but this may be the biggest reason, because what happened there was they let his contract expire by accident. Okay, normally when a guy's contract is coming due, you go to him, you want to get him to re-sign or renew. His contract, it expired. And I think Jim Ross has since claimed he takes responsibility. He was the head of talent relations. It was an oversight. It shouldn't have happened. So the problem is this guy's contract expires. Meanwhile, he's the Intercontinental Champion. And they have him booked to lose to a woman in a pay-per-view match. That was the good housekeeping match against China. But the guy's contract expired. So from WWE's position, Jarrett blackmailed them into paying him, it was something like $300,000, to get him to do the job and to drop the belt on his way out, because he was leaving. And Jarrett, I think in interviews, Jarrett has claimed he didn't hold anybody hostage. It was actually money that Vince McMahon owed him. The fact is, he said, you owe me or I want X number of dollars. He basically pushed him up against the wall and put a knife to Vince's throat, whether he deserved it or not. And Vince is no angel, so he probably did deserve it. And they had no choice. What do you do? I mean, it's the day of the pay-per-view. You got this big title match booked. So they paid him the money. I'm sure that pissed Vince McMahon off a lot. But that probably is what sealed his fate. I'm sure he wasn't Vince's favorite person, but that probably sealed his fate. And his, you know, in Vince McMahon's eyes, Jarrett fucked him over. He held him up for money. Right? The same shit they claimed the Ultimate Warrior did. And then on top of all of that, Jarrett goes and forms TNA. And, despite whatever WWE says, they do look at TNA as competition. Maybe less so now, but they do look at TNA as competition, and they don't want guys going to TNA, and if you do, it's a mark against you. And so if they say they're not competition because they're not the same thing, we're sports entertainment, and they're wrestling, they're full of shit. I don't care what they say. So Vince probably looks at the guy as disloyal, right? Difficult to work with. And let's face facts, Jarrett wasn't even that big of a star. I mean, he positioned himself as one in TNA, of course. But Jeff Jarrett was never a big star. It's not like he was The Rock or anything like that. Believe me, I'm sure Vince would be willing to look past all of that if he was. But he's not. Not even close. He's Jeff Jarrett. So Vince has no incentive to bring him back. What does he gain by bringing Jeff Jarrett back and making up with him? What does Jeff Jarrett in 2015, almost 2016, bring to the table for Vince McMahon? Ratings? A new audience? Vince, he has no reason to bring the guy back. I wouldn't bring him back. I have nothing against Jarrett, but, you know, why bother? I mean, they're stocked on talent. They don't need him. He doesn't offer him anything. Big Zeus, if that is your real name, in DC. How come Ken Patera doesn't get enough recognition from WWE? They obviously pride themselves on the number of legitimate athletes that have made successful transitions into pro wrestling. Iron Sheik, Mark Henry, Kurt Angle made their careers off of their Olympic past. But when it comes to mentioning past Olympians or great Intercontinental champions, Ken Patera is omitted from that talk. Is he on the outs with WWE? Ken Patera is a fucking lunatic. WWE.com, they did like one of those where are they now type deals a while back on Ken Patera. But I mean, other than that, they never mentioned the guy. He was a very accomplished Olympic, I don't know if he was a weightlifter or a powerlifter. I don't even know what the difference is, frankly. Weightlifting, powerlifting, it's all the same thing to me, but he was a great heel. You know, he wrestled a lot of the big stars, Hogan, Andre. He was a big star, big heel. But Patera is a very opinionated guy. He is not one to mince words when he does interviews. He has talked so much shit about so many people, including Vince McMahon, I wouldn't want to have anything to do with him either. And going to jail for the McDonald's incident, you know, I talked about this in another mailbag question a few months ago. Somebody asked me about it. Yeah, basically, he threw a giant boulder, or is alleged to have thrown a giant boulder through the window of McDonald's very late at night. They wouldn't serve him. You know, and it's tough for these guys. They're on the road late at night. You know, McDonald's is one of the only places usually that's probably open for them to even eat. I don't know if that's what happened here, but they wouldn't serve him, and so he threw a boulder through the window. And he denies doing it. And he also denies roughing up the police officers when they came to arrest him back at the hotel. It was him and Masa Saito. But he went to jail for it. Vince brought him back. When he got out, he was in jail for like 2 years. He brought him back. Didn't do much with him. I mean, he was a total waste when he came back. He came back as like a baby face because he had been managed previously by Bobby Heenan. And so the storyline was he felt betrayed by Heenan for not visiting him in jail or whatever. So he came back as a baby face. He was gone, I think, within a year. You can't talk about Ken Patera without talking about the McDonald's incident. And if you even try to bring it up to him, he loses his shit. You know, I watched, I think it was an RF video shoot with Patera. You know what? Gabe Sapolsky was doing the interview. So it may not have been RF video. Unless Gabe was working for RF video at some point. Maybe it wasn't RF video. But it was definitely Gabe doing the interview. This was many years ago. And Patera treated Gabe like such a piece of shit during that interview. I mean, on the one hand, look, I can appreciate the guy's honesty. The one thing I will say about Ken Patera from, you know, what little I've seen of his, you know, the shoot stuff that he's done, he doesn't sugarcoat shit like a lot of other guys do. But that doesn't give you the right to treat other people the way that he treated Gabe in that interview. I mean, what, the guy's a fucking piece of garbage. You know, he was constantly, like, whenever Gabe would bring up, whether it's McDonald's or something, he would stop him. And he wasn't, like, joking. He was completely serious. He was unhinged. He would stop him in the middle of the interview and call him a cocksucker, you know, and among other things. All of these horrible things. I mean, if I was Vince, I wouldn't want to have anything to do with him. I mean, just because you were an Olympian and you went to jail and you feel it was some great injustice that was done to you, it doesn't make you any less of a piece of shit when you treat other people like that. Danny writes in, at WrestleMania 17, Paul Heyman said Bobby Heenan was wrestling's Johnny Carson. Do you think Bobby Heenan is wrestling's Johnny Carson? And if so, what other wrestler-comedian comparisons would you make? One comparison I would make is that Jerry Lawler is the David Letterman of wrestling. They were both great during the 80s and the 90s, but it seems somehow they both just became stale and boring. Ah, touche. I'd say that sounds about right. Heenan was the Carson of wrestling. I think that's a good comparison. And I would say today, John Cena is the Dane Cook of pro wrestling. I don't find either one of them funny. And yet somehow, they've been very successful at it. I'd say Roman Reigns is probably the Carrot Top of pro wrestling. They use bad material that isn't funny, but they're fucking jacked. Or at least I shouldn't say, I don't even know if Carrot Top is still jacked. There was a point, he used to be jacked. I haven't seen a recent picture of him, but the last I saw Carrot Top, he was all roided up. Chris has a quick buy or sell. We'll do two mini ones and then one bigger one. Edge's Money in the Bank cash-in from 2006 or Seth Rollins' Money in the Bank cash-in at WrestleMania 31? I'm going to buy on Seth. Selling on Edge. I mean, I know Edge was the first, but I mean, come on. Seth Rollins cashing in during the main event of WrestleMania. He beats two guys, including Brock Lesnar, to win the championship. Ends up holding the belt for most of the year. They built the whole freaking company around. They made him the guy. Or you know, one of the guys. I think it's safe to say that Seth has the bigger cash in. Edge, you know, Edge with the title, he opened a lot of eyes because ratings actually spiked right after he won that belt, but then they took the title off him like 2 or 3 weeks later and put it right back on John Cena. So I'm buying on Rollins and I'm selling on Edge. Jerry from Long Island, buy or sell? Triple H and Chyna from 1999 or Triple H and Stephanie from 2000? I like the McMahon-Helmsley era for what it was, and Triple H was a legit champion in my eyes during that time, but rewatching old Raw episodes from 99, I think Triple H and Chyna looked better side by side, and Chyna was a more effective asset at ringside. What do you think? I like the Triple H and Stephanie pairing. Not so much now, because I'm just sick and tired of them, but at the start I liked it, but Triple H and Chyna were the better pairing. I'm buying on Triple H and Chyna, I'm selling on him and Stephanie. And Chyna was far more instrumental on camera, and maybe not so much behind the scenes. I think his association with Stephanie ended up benefiting him far more. But on camera, you know, very early in his career, Chyna was much more valuable in getting Triple H over to that next level. I mean, think about where he was pre-Chyna. He ran through 2, 3, 4 different valets or managers or bodyguards or whatever. I mean, he had Mr. Hughes for like a month. He had, didn't he have some other woman, I think, or Mr. Perfect? Yeah, they tried to put a few different people with him to get him going, and it just wasn't working. And then, boom, they bring in China, and it's like everything changed. I mean, think about where he was pre-China and then post-China. She was an attraction. She was a freak show attraction at first. That's what she was. And she helped get him over by association, so that's why I'm buying on them. Johnny from the UK. Buy or sell? Kane or Big Show? I'm thinking in terms of their individual contribution to the industry, as neither would win prizes for in-ring work alone. That's a good one. That is a good buy or sell. You know, you got two big guys that have been around forever. They've worked with each other. They've worked with everybody else. People are sick to death of seeing them on TV, although Big Show hasn't been on TV much lately. They've actually toned down both of them, Kane and Big Show, so I give them credit for that. When I look at their careers, you know, Kane has been around, not with that Kane character, but he's been around a little longer than Big Show has. And when Kane debuted the, or Glenn Jacobs, I guess, debuted the Isaac Yankum character, you know, he was already in the business for a few years. Big Show didn't debut until, he actually debuted that year while he was playing the Isaac Yankum character is when Big Show debuted, and he did it against Hulk Hogan. Not only did he debut against Hulk Hogan, he beat him for the world title in his very first match. Now, granted, they stripped him of the belt right after, but still. You know, and I think it was some lame DQ that the title changed hands. But, I mean, come on, that's a pretty impressive debut. Then you look at Kane, right? So Isaac Yankum was a failure, Fake Diesel was a dumb idea, but then Kane, right? Fucking jackpot this guy hit. He debuts with that character 2 years later. Kane's debut, in my opinion, is still, to this day, the greatest debut in WWE history. When I think of the top three greatest WWE debuts, I think of Kane, Taz, and Chris Jericho. You know, this guy, he debuted during a pay-per-view main event, ripped the frickin' door off, he tombstoned The Undertaker. It's a pretty badass way to make your debut. And even Big Show too, when he came to WWE, comes up through the ring, he beats up Steve Austin, throws him into the cage. So, both guys have that in common. They both made an impact on day one. Another thing they have in common, they share the record for the greatest number of turns, I think, in company history. They've flip-flopped between heel and face so many times, I don't even know what the total number is, but there's nobody else who even comes close to either one of those guys. And they'll turn five more times before they retire, I guarantee it. They've both been part of some god-awful storylines. They both had terrible matches, sometimes with each other. But they've also both had good matches. You know, Big Show and Brock Lesnar had some great matches. I like their stretcher match at Judgment Day back in 03. Kane and Kurt Angle once had a really good U.S. title match on SmackDown that doesn't get talked about. I think Kane and Kurt had a match at WrestleMania 1 year. I think it was 18. That wasn't nearly as good. You got to find the U.S. title match they had on SmackDown. There was a chain match that Kane had on pay-per-view once with Triple H. I mean, you could find some pretty good Kane matches over the years if you look hard enough. It's not easy, but if you look, they're there. They're both very versatile. You want them to do comedy, they could do comedy. Big Show's a fucking funny guy. And when Kane was doing corporate Kane some of the time, or the Team Hell No stuff, you know, he could be very funny too. You want them to do comedy, they'll do comedy. You want them to be the monster, they can be the monster. You want them to do the tag team thing, they could do the tag team thing. You know, Jericho was great. Team Hell No was very entertaining. And again, they've even teamed up together, Kane and Big Show. And by the way, Team Hell No, entertaining, but I still like Kane and X-Pac better as a team. But that's just me. Now, they're in the twilight of their careers. God, I hope so. They're in the twilight of their careers. They're closer to the end than they are to the beginning, right? And now they're able to work with a lot of the younger guys, the younger generation. They could teach them. They're the elder statesmen on that roster. But here's maybe the biggest difference between the two of them, and it's why I'm buying Kane and I'm selling Big Show. No matter what they do with Kane, they can unmask him, which people thought was going to be just death for him. They could unmask him. They can brand him a murderer. They can, you know, have him take jumper cables to Shane McMahon's balls. They can set him on fire. They can have him doing goofy comedy with Daniel Bryan. They can put him in a fucking suit and tie and turn him corporate. They could put the mask back on him again for the 15th time. No matter what they do with this guy, he remains over and, you know, popular with the audience. No matter how stale he may get, when you turn him, right? If he's a heel and he's, oh, so sick of Kane, right? Then he goes away, comes back as a babyface, everyone's cheering. When you turn him or you put that mask back on him after it's been off for a while, people mark the fuck out for Kane. For 18 years, this guy has been around nonstop. He didn't leave and go to TNA and come back or, you know, had neck surgery and was out for a year and a half. Pretty much nonstop, full-time, very little downtime for major injuries, which is incredible for a guy that big who's been doing this as long as he has. He's still coming off the top rope at 6'9 or whatever he is, and he's still over. I don't hate Kane. I don't really have a massive problem with him other than, you know, he was overexposed. It's kind of why I'm worried about New Day right now. You could take something that's good, but then you overexpose it. People get tired of it. I think Kane, mask Kane, in short doses or select doses is fine. But no matter what you do with this guy, at the end of the day, he's still over. You know, for all the praise that people heap on The Undertaker, yes, you know, The Undertaker has been doing this a little bit longer than Kane has, but between all of his injuries and all the things he's, all the muscle tears and everything else, and all the years recently where he's only wrestled once a year, I'm thinking that Kane is about even with him now as far as time served in that company. And if he isn't even, he's pretty damn close. And I think Kane deserves the same credit as The Undertaker does. I mean, Undertaker may have better matches on his resume. There's nothing even comparable to Undertaker and Shawn Michaels or Undertaker and Kurt Angle that one time at No Way Out. Kane doesn't have anything like that on his resume, but I've got as much respect for Kane as I do for The Undertaker. Big Show, you know, he had that period where he left the company for about a year, then he came back. But Big Show is not over the way that Kane is. People still mark the fuck out for Kane. Nobody's marking the fuck out for the Big Show. You know, people are largely tired of him, and they don't seem to care when he comes back, right? I don't see anybody asking, hey, when's Big Show going to be back? Nobody cares. Fans just, they seem to connect in a way with Kane and that character that they don't with Big Show. You know, they've both been very valuable to Vince McMahon. They've both been very valuable to that company. But I think Kane more so than Big Show, so that's why I'm buying on him. This week's sad tweet comes from Sean Waltman at The Real X-Pac. Saddest thing I saw all week. He got a tweet from a fan asking him, has China ever given you a naked Bronco Buster? To which he replied, wish I could say no. That poor bastard. If you could find a sadder tweet than that, I'd love to see it. And finally here, we end with Match Anatomy, a rare TNA match, again, by request of one of our faithful listeners. Sting and Abyss for the NWA World Heavyweight title at Genesis, November 19, 2006. This was the same show where Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe met for the very first time, and Kurt ended Joe's undefeated streak. This was Sting's very first title defense. He had won his first championship in TNA the month before, their Bound for Glory show. He beat Jeff Jarrett. He was still being recognized as the NWA title at this point. It came out. It was the old, like, old school Ric Flair NWA belt. Meanwhile, Abyss, now, this is something else here. But this is also TNA, so keep that in mind. Abyss had won the right to challenge for the championship. We were told by Mike Tenay on commentary, by winning what was called a Fight for the Right tournament. Now, I had never heard of this before, so I had to do some research. Apparently, TNA only did two of these things, and this was the first one. And when you learn how this works, it becomes clear why they only did two of them. It starts with an old Vince Russo specialty, the reverse battle royal, where all the guys start outside the ring and they try to climb and fight their way inside. Then it turns into a traditional battle royal, and then it comes down to the final two people, It ends with a singles match. Whoever wins that goes right to the finals. Right, so that's not the end, okay? That's only to fill one spot. Now, in the meantime, there's a single elimination tournament that starts with all the guys who were eliminated from the Battle Royal. So basically, all the losers, they shove them in this tournament. And the winner of the tournament is decided in a triple threat match in the finals. So the finals of the tournament, it's not a singles match, it's a three-way match. That winner, you still following? Okay. That winner then faces the winner of the Battle Royal to determine the number one contender. This all seems like a lot of effort for nothing. I can't think of a more convoluted way to determine a number one contender. Just have a fucking match! Or a fucking tournament, or a fucking Battle Royal. I mean, I have a headache just going through all that. So anyway, Abyss beat AJ Styles in the finals, so he won the right to meet Sting. What's confusing to me, besides everything I just said in the last 90 seconds, is why then on the final episode of Impact, before Abyss's big title match with Sting, why did they have Abyss tap out to Kurt Angle? I saw the results, I said, this couldn't be the week before, or whatever it was, a few days before the pay-per-view, and no, it was. I mean, not that there's any shame in tapping out to Kurt Angle, especially he was new in the company at the time, big star. But of all the people they could have fed to Kurt Angle in his first TV match, why would it be your number one contender who just won this giant convoluted tournament? But then I remind myself who was writing their show at the time, and I realize why none of this seems to make any sense. Sting and Abyss had actually, I thought they had themselves a pretty good brawl. This was a good match, at least until the finish. Sting, who at this point would have been, let's see, 2006 minus 1959. I only remember that because I knew that Sting was born the same year that my mother was born. So that would make him 47. So he was 47 years old at that time. Came out wearing no shirt. No singlet. I don't think he wrestled with that look probably since right before the Crow gimmick when he first disappeared off TV in 96. And I got to tell you, the guy was in tremendous physical shape. And he knew it, too. You know, just like in those later TNA days when he'd wear a t-shirt all the time. He probably knew he didn't look as good as he would have liked. You know, guys get very self-conscious about that kind of thing. Ric Flair said the same thing. That's why he started wearing t-shirts during matches in WCW. He lost his confidence. But Sting was very confident here. We were told that Abyss had hung Sting upside down on some live two-hour special that TNA had, I guess, a few weeks leading up to the show. And I don't know if it was just a two-hour Impact or some other special show. I have no idea. And I guess that really pissed Sting off because he came out here, a man with a purpose. He all full of piss and vinegar, went right after Abyss. Abyss rolls out to the floor. Sting propels himself over the top rope for a crossbody onto Abyss, a fucking plancha, out of the ring at 47. And I gotta say, you know, watching this between the way he looked and the way he was moving around and everything, watching this made me very sad. It made me very sad that Sting wasted his last really good years in TNA instead of going to WWE and wrestling guys like Undertaker, who was still having great matches at that point, and Randy Orton, guys like that. So they fight into the crowd, fight back out of the crowd. Sting takes a hard armpit bump across the metal guardrail when he misses a Stinger splash. Now, Abyss walks over by the stage. Okay, they have the ramp that leads up to the stage. He walks along the side of the ramp, so he's down below. And he sets up two tables, covered in barbed wire. And he tries to powerbomb Sting off the stage through the two tables. But Sinister Minister is there trying to talk him out of it. The referee is trying to talk him out of it, and he thinks better of it. Can't win the title if you're disqualified. So they take it back to the ring. Sting is just flying from corner to corner with Stinger splashes like it's the fucking Clash of the Champions against Flair in 88. Goes for one too many of them. He eats a foot to the face. Now, this is where Abyss goes. He grabs a giant sack full of thumbtacks, which is important because he doesn't use them right away. Sting is the one who ends up spreading tacks all over the ring. And keep in mind, I had never seen this match before. If I did, I didn't have any memory of it before I went back and I watched it here. So I'm thinking to myself, there's no way Sting's taken a thumbtack bump. Well, I was wrong. Sting has Abyss beaten in the Scorpion Deathlock. Sinister Minister, I still call him Sinister Minister. I guess here he was James Mitchell. Mitchell pulls the referee out of the ring. Sting gets up. He turns around into a choke slam by Abyss onto the thumbtacks. I don't know why. I just never thought I'd see Sting taking a choke slam bump onto thumbtacks, but there it was. And again, no shirt, no singlet, no padding, no protection, no nothing. Just boom, choke slam onto the tacks. And I know Ric Flair did it when he wrestled Big Show on ECW. As a matter of fact, I think that may have been the same year. Might have been. This match actually may have taken place not long after that Flair-Big Show match. So who knows? Maybe Sting felt, hey, you know, if the old man can do it, so can I. Although, Flair wasn't chokeslam. Big Show just kind of flung him onto the tacks. But anyway, Abyss got a great near fall out of it. Sting not only kicked out, he popped up and no-sold the whole thing. Tacks are sticking out of his back. Blood is dripping down his back and his arm. He knocks Abyss down onto the tacks. Abyss does a face plant onto them. Lucky for him, he's wearing a mask. Scorpion Deathlock again. Referee is distracted by Mitchell, so Sting says, well, fuck it. He puts James Mitchell in the Scorpion. Sting takes Abyss outside, grabs a cable that's hanging from the ceiling. They said, the same one that, you know, he uses to rappel, which I don't think you should probably be talking about after Owen. But anyway, he ties up Abyss's legs so he can pull him up, hang him upside down from the cable, I guess as revenge for what he did to Sting on that special they said a few weeks earlier. The problem with this, even though it looked cool to see Abyss hanging upside down as Sting killed him dead with chair shot after chair shot, the problem is that it took forever. This took forever. Not quite as long as the Roman Reigns-Sheamus segment at the end of Raw last week, but this took forever just to set up. They have to tie the legs, we have to pull them up. I mean, it took a few minutes just to do that. Then he had to get him down. So they do that. They go up the ramp. Sting goes to powerbomb Abyss through the barbed wire tables that are still sitting down there. Referee tells him not to do it. Sting swats him away. But the referee continues to annoy him, and so Sting clotheslines the shit out of the referee. And then he throws Abyss off the stage through the barbed wire tables. The referee, meanwhile, calls for the bell, and he awards the championship to Abyss on a DQ. Because TNA and the NWA, many years before that, had a rule where the world title could change hands on a disqualification. Now, in theory, it's not the dumbest rule in the world. I mean, if you really think about it, right? You should lose your title if you get disqualified. Especially if you're like a heel who tries to get disqualified on purpose. I mean, if we're trying to look at this logically and put a little bit of realism in this, you should not be allowed to do that. You should not be allowed to DQ yourself to keep your belt. So I don't necessarily hate the concept. The problem I have with this is that everybody just seemed confused because I don't think they ever mentioned the fact that the title could change hands on a DQ. They didn't put it in the match graphic before the match. And if it ever happened before in TNA, and I don't know that it ever did, it hadn't happened in a long-ass time because these people had no idea what was going on. I mean, TNA historians listening to this may let me know if this ever happened before because I couldn't tell you, but I mean, this whole thing just came off badly. Very badly. Very anticlimactic the way that this match ended. Not only for the match to end, but for Sting's first title reign to come to an end only a month after he won it. You know, and here's another thing. Where was the fucking disqualification when Sting hung the guy upside down by his feet and was whacking him with chair shots? I mean, I've seen referees let some things go and be a little lenient during title matches. But the guy's hanging upside down getting beaten with a chair, if that's not a DQ, then I don't know what is. So that was stupid. And speaking of the referee, one other note. Took me a little while before I realized this. Actually, it was midway through the match when I realized this. the referee, I'm looking at him, I'm like, this guy looks awfully familiar, this Rudy Charles guy. Well, that's because he's a referee now in WWE. So, that would explain that. Abyss, just a little post-mortem here on this match. Abyss held the championship for a couple of months. He ended up losing it to Christian Cage. Christian, in this storyline they started, said he knew a deep, dark secret about Abyss, which Sting later revealed to be that Abyss was once locked up in jail for shooting his father in the back 3 times and putting him in a coma. Poor guy didn't have to shoot him. All he had to do was show him a tape of one of these 3-hour Raws. That'll put anybody in a fucking coma. But then later on, they revealed that Abyss didn't really shoot his father. It was actually his mother that did it, and he was covering for her as a way to protect her. Anyway, enough of all that. This was a good match. I thought the finish was very weak and very dumb. Just the way it came off. And again, maybe it wouldn't have been so bad had they done a better job of just educating people ahead of time about the DQ. But that is your match anatomy. Don't forget, next week it begins. 15 straight weeks of basically WCW match anatomy here on the Sound Off. It's our top 15 matches in WCW history countdown. We'll kick it off next Sunday. We're going to be doing one match per week, just like the top 8 countdown I did a few weeks ago. And this will lead right into the 15-year anniversary of the death of WCW, which, again, I consider to be that last Nitro that aired in March of 01. That's going to be 15 years. Wow. And let me tell you some wrestling. Not that WCW was any great shakes there at the end, but wrestling has not recovered from the death of that company, and it's actually a lot worse off because of it. So we'll start that countdown next week. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. Don't forget to vote in our Raw poll on Twitter every Monday night as soon as the show goes off the air. And keep voting for us to nominate us in the Wrestling Radio Awards. You can vote once a day. WrestlingRadioAwards.com. And leave us some love in iTunes and on Stitcher. I haven't mentioned this in a while, but you know, we are a 5-star rated podcast on iTunes, which I'm very proud of. And when you write a review on iTunes and when you write one on Stitcher, you can actually write one instead of just rating us on a star system. It actually helps the podcast out a lot, and it lets other people know that you think it's something that is worth them checking out if they've never heard us before. So you can head on over to iTunes or Stitcher and leave some love for the podcast. We will be back next weekend, episode 414. Hope you enjoyed the show. We covered a lot of stuff this week. This is a long show, but a fun one. Even though my foot fell asleep. Actually, my whole leg fell asleep. So I'm going to walk around here now like the Undertaker for the next few minutes. So as I try to get some blood flow back into my leg before the gangrene sets in, thank you for tuning in, and we will see you back here for 414 next weekend. Until then, be well, stay safe, and take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan's WCW contract splattered all over the internet. He got a $2 million signing bonus, 25% of the ticket revenue from all Nitro and Thunder events that he appeared on. He also got $20,000 per month for as long as he was part of the NWO, 50% of the profits from any Hulk Hogan merchandise that was sold, and a minimum $675,000 for any pay-per-view he appeared on. You know what I say? I say good for him. If I could get that kind of deal for myself, if somebody wanted me that badly, they were that stupid, then great. Always ask for what you feel you're worth. Your boss should have the guts to say no. WCW wanted to blow this guy so badly, they put a towel down on the floor so they wouldn't get rug burned.
Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.